Leviathan. Chapter 1. Of Sense. Concerning the thoughts of man, I will consider them first singly, and afterwards in train, or dependence upon one another. Singly, they are every one a representation or appearance, of some quality, or other accident of a body without us, which is commonly called an object. Which object worketh on the eyes, ears, and other parts of man's body, and by diversity of working, produceth diversity of apparence. The original of them all, is that which we call sense, for there is no conception in a man's mind, which hath not at first, totally, or by parts, been begotten upon the organs of sense, the rest are derived from that original. To know the natural cause of sense, is not very necessary to the business now in hand, and I have elsewhere written of the same at large. Nevertheless, to fill each part of my present method, I will briefly deliver the same in this place. The cause of sense, is the external body, or object, which presseth the organ proper to each sense, either immediately, as in the taste and touch, or mediately, as in seeing, hearing, and smelling, which pressure, by the mediation of nerves, and other strings, and membranes of the body, continued inwards to the brain, and heart, causeth there a resistance, or counter-pressure, or endeavor of the heart, to deliver itself, which endeavor because outward, seemeth to be some matter without. And this seeming, or fancy, is that which men call sense, and consisteth, as to the eye, in a light, or color figured, to the ear, in a sound, to the nostril, in an odor, to the tongue and palate, in a savor, and to the rest of the body, in heat, cold, hardness, softness, and such other qualities, as we discern by feeling. All which qualities called sensible, are in the object that causeth them, but so many several motions of the matter, by which it presseth our organs diversely. Neither in us that are pressed, are they anything else, but divers motions, for motion, produceth nothing but motion, but their appearance to us is fancy, the same waking, that dreaming. And as pressing, rubbing, or striking the eye, makes us fancy a light, and pressing the ear, produceth a din, so do the bodies also we see, or hear, produce the same by their strong, though unobserved action, for if those colors, and sounds, were in the bodies, or objects that cause them, they could not be severed from them, as by glasses, and in echoes by a reflection, we see they are, where we know the thing we see, is in one place, the appearance, in another. And though at some certain distance, the real, and very object seem invested with the fancy it begets in us, yet still the object is one thing, the image or fancy is another. So that sense in all cases, is nothing else but original fancy, caused, as I have said, by the pressure, that is, by the motion, of external things upon our eyes, ears, and other organs thereunto ordained. But the philosophy schools, through all the universities of Christendom, grounded upon certain texts of Aristotle, teach another doctrine, and say, for the cause of vision, that the thing seen, sendeth forth on every side a visible species in English, a visible show, apparition, or aspect, or a being seen, the receiving whereof into the eye, is seeing. And for the cause of hearing, that the thing heard, sendeth forth an audible species, that is, an audible aspect, or audible being seen, which entering at the ear, maketh hearing. Nay for the cause of understanding also, they say the thing understood sendeth forth intelligible species, that is, an intelligible being seen, which coming into the understanding, makes us understand. I say not this, as disapproving the use of universities, but because I am to speak hereafter of their office in a commonwealth, I must let you see on all occasions by the way, what things would be amended in them, amongst which the frequency of insignificant speech is one. Chapter 2. Of Imagination. That when a thing lies still, unless somewhat else stir it, it will lie still forever, is a truth that no man doubts of. But that when a thing is in motion, it will eternally be in motion, unless somewhat else stay it, though the reason be the same, namely, that nothing can change itself, is not so easily assented to. For men measure, not one the other men, but all other things, by themselves, and because they find themselves subject after motion to pain, and lassitude, think everything else grows weary of motion, and seeks repose of its own accord, little considering, whether it be not some other motion, wherein that desire of rest they find in themselves, consisteth. From hence it is, that the schools say, heavy bodies fall downwards, out of an appetite to rest, and to conserve their nature in that place which is most proper for them, ascribing appetite, and knowledge of what is good for their conservation, which is more than man has, to things inanimate absurdly. When a body is once in motion, it moveth, unless something else hinder it, eternally, and whatsoever hindereth it, cannot in an instant, but in time, and by degrees quite extinguish it, and as we see in the water, Though the winds cease, the waves give not over rolling for a long time after, so also it happeneth in that motion, which is made in the internal parts of a man, then, when he sees, dreams, and see. For after the object is removed, or the eye shut, we still retain an image of the thing seen, though more obscure than when we see it. And this is it, that Latines call imagination, from the image made in seeing, and apply the same, though improperly, to all the other senses. But the Greeks call it fancy, which signifies appearance, and is as proper to one sense, as to another. Imagination therefore is nothing but decaying sense, and is found in men, and many other living creatures, as well sleeping, as waking. Memory. The decay of sense in men waking, is not the decay of the motion made in sense, but an obscuring of it, in such manner, as the light of the sun obscureth the light of the stars, which stars do no less exercise their vertebrae by which they are visible, in the day, than in the night. But because amongst many stroacts, which arise, ears, and other organs receive from external bodies, the predominant one is sensible, therefore the light of the sun being predominant, we are not affected with the action of the stars. And any object being removed from our eyes, though the impression it made in us remain, yet other objects more present succeeding, and working on us, the imagination of the past is obscured, and made weak, as the voice of a man is in the noise of the day. From whence it followeth, that the longer the time is, after the sight, or sense of any object, the weaker is the imagination. For the continual change of man's body, destroys in time the parts which in sense were moved, so that the distance of time, and of place, hath one and the same effect in us. For as at a distance of place, that which we look at, appears dimmer, and without distinction of the smaller parts, and as voices grow weak, and inarticulate, so also after great distance of time, our imagination of the past is weak, and we lose, for example, of cities we have seen, many particular streets, and of actions, many particular circumstances. This decaying sense, when we would express the thing itself, I mean fancy itself, we call imagination, as I said before, but when we would express the decay, and signify that the sense is fading, old, and past, it is called memory. So that imagination and memory, are but one thing, which for divers considerations hath divers names. Much memory, or memory of many things, is called experience. Again, imagination being only of those things which have been formerly perceived by sense, either all at once, or by parts at several times, the former, which is the imagining the whole object, as it was presented to the sense, is simple imagination, as when one imagineth a man, or horse, which he hath seen before. The other is compounded, as when from the sight of a man at one time, and of a horse at another, we conceive in our mind a centaur. So when a man compoundeth the image of his own person, with the image of the actions of another man, as when a man imagines himself a Hercules, or an Alexander, which happeneth often to them that are much taken with reading of Romans, it is a compound imagination, and properly but a fiction of the mind. There be also other imaginations that rise in men, though waking, from the great impression made in sense, as from gazing upon the sun, the impression leaves an image of the sun before our eyes a long time after, and from being long and vehemently attent upon geometrical figures, a man shall in the dark, though awake, have the images of lines, and angles before his eyes, which kind of fancy hath no particular name, as being a thing that doth not commonly fall into men's discourse. Dreams. The imaginations of them that sleep, are those we call dreams. And these also, as all other imaginations, have been before, either totally, or by parcels in the sense. And because in sense, the brain, and nerves, which are the necessary organs of sense, are so benumbed in sleep, as not easily to be moved by the action of external objects, there can happen in sleep, no imagination, and therefore no dream, but what proceeds from the agitation of the inward parts of man's body, which inward parts, for the connection they have with the brain, and other organs, when they be distempered, do keep the same in motion, whereby the imaginations there formerly made, appear as if a man were waking, saving that the organs of sense being now benumbed, so as there is no new object, which can master and obscure them with a more vigorous impression, a dream must needs be more clear, in this silence of sense, than are our waking thoughts. And hence it cometh to pass, that it is a hard matter, and by many thought impossible to distinguish exactly between sense and dreaming. For my part, when I consider, that in dreams, I do not often, nor constantly think of the same persons, places, objects, and actions that I do waking, nor remember so long a train of coherent thoughts, dreaming, as at other times, and because waking I often observe the absurdity of dreams, but never dream of the absurdities of my waking thoughts, I am well satisfied, that being awake, I know I dream not, though when I dream, I think myself awake. And seeing dreams are caused by the distemper of some of the inward parts of the body, divers distempers must needs cause different dreams. And hence it is, that lying cold breedeth dreams of fear, and raiseth a thought an image of some fearful object, the motion from the brain to the inner parts, and from the inner parts to the brain being reciprocal, and that is anger causeth heat in some parts of the body, when we are awake, so when we sleep, the overheating of the same parts causeth anger, and raiseth up in the brain the imagination of an enemy. In the same manner, as natural kindness, when we are awake causeth desire, and desire makes heat in certain other parts of the body, so also, too much heat in those parts, while we sleep, raiseth in the brain an imagination of some kindness shown. In sum, our dreams are the reverse of our waking imaginations, the motion when we are awake, beginning at one end, and when we dream, at another. Apparitions or visions. The most difficult discerning of a man's dream, from his waking thoughts, is then, when by some accident we observe not that we have slept, which is easy to happen to a man full of fearful thoughts, and whose conscience is much troubled, and that sleepeth, without the circumstances, of going to bed, or putting off his clothes, as one that nodeth in attire. For he that taketh pains, and industriously lays himself to sleep, in case any uncouth and exorbitant fancy come unto him, cannot easily think it other than a dream. We read of Marcus Brutus, one that had his life given him by Julius Caesar, and was also his favorite, and notwithstanding murdered him, how at Philippi, the night before he gave battle to Augustus Caesar, he saw a fearful apparition, which is commonly related by historians as a vision, but considering the circumstances, one may easily judge to have been but a short dream. For sitting in his tent, pensive and troubled with the horror of his rash act, it was not hard for him, slumbering in the cold, to dream of that which most affrighted him, which fear, as by degrees it made him wake, so also it must needs make the apparition by degrees to vanish, and having no assurance that he slept, he could have no cause to think it a dream, or anything but a vision. And this is no very rare accident, for even they that be perfectly awake, if they be timorous, and superstitious, possessed with fearful tales, and alone in the dark, are subject to the like fancies, and believe they see spirits and dead men's ghosts walking in churchyards, whereas it is either their fancy only, or else the knavery of such persons, as make use of such superstitious fear, to pass disguised in the night, to places they would not be known to haunt. From this ignorance of how to distinguish dreams, and other strong fancies, from vision and sense, did arise the greatest part of the religion of the Gentiles in time past, that worshipped satyrs, fauns, nymphs, and the like, and now it dies the opinion that rude people have of fairies, ghosts, and goblins, and of the power of witches. For as for witches, I think not that their witchcraft has any real power, but yet that they are justly punished, for the false belief they have, that they can do such mischief, joined with their purpose to do it if they can, their trade being nearer to a new religion, than to a craft or science. And for fairies, and walking ghosts, the opinion of them has I think been on purpose, either taught, or not confuted, to keep in credit the use of exorcism, of crosses, of holy water, and other such inventions of ghostly men. Nevertheless, there is no doubt, but God can make unnatural apparitions. But that he does it so often, as men need to fear such things, more than they fear the stay, or change, of the course of nature, which he also can stay, and change, is no point of Christian faith. But evil men under pretext that God can do anything, are so bold as to say anything when it serves their turn, though they think it untrue, it is the part of a wise man, to believe them no further, than right reason makes that which they say, appear credible. If this superstitious fear of spirits were taken away, and with it, prognostics from dreams, false prophecies, and many other things depending thereon, by which, crafty ambitious persons abuse the simple people, men would be much more fitted than they are for civil obedience. And this ought to be the work of the schools, but they rather nourish such doctrine. For, not knowing what imagination, or the senses are, what they receive, they teach, some saying, that imaginations rise of themselves, and have no cause, others that they rise most commonly from the will, and that good thoughts are blown, inspired, into a man, by God, and of ill thoughts by the devil, or that good thoughts are powered, infused, into a man, by God, and of ill ones by the devil. Some say the senses receive the species of things, and deliver them to the common sense, and the common sense delivers them over to the fancy, and the fancy to the memory, and the memory to the judgment, like handing of things from one to another, with many words making nothing understood. Understanding. The imagination that is raised in man, or any other creature endued with the faculty of imagining, by words, or other voluntary senia, is that we generally call understanding, and is common to man and beast. For a dog by custom will understand the call, or the rating of his master, and so will many other beasts. That understanding which is peculiar to man, is the understanding not only his will, but his conceptions and thoughts, by the sequel and contexture of the names of things into affirmations, negations, and other forms of speech, and of this kindy of understanding I shall speak hereafter. Chapter 3. Of the consequence or train of imaginations. By consequence, or train of thoughts, I understand that succession of one thought to another, which is called, to distinguish it from discourse in words, mental discourse. When a man thinketh on anything whatsoever, his next thought after, is not altogether so casual as it seems to be. Not every thought to every thought succeeds indifferently. But as we have no imagination, whereof we have not formerly had sense, in whole, or in parts, so we have no transition from one imagination to another, whereof we never had the like before in our senses. The reason whereof is this. All fancies are motions within us, relics of those made in the sense, and those motions that immediately succeeded one another in the sense, continue also together after sense, insomuch as the former coming again to take place, and be predominant, the later followeth, by coherence of the matter moved, is such manner, as water upon a plain table is drawn which way any one part of it is guided by the finger. But because in sense, to one and the same thing perceived, sometimes one thing, sometimes another succeedeth, it comes to pass in time, that in the imagining of any thing, there is no certainty what we shall imagine next, only this is certain, it shall be something that succeeded the same before, at one time or another. Train of thoughts unguided. This train of thoughts, or mental discourse, is of two sorts. The first is unguided, without designee, and inconstant, wherein there is no passionate thought, to govern and direct those that follow, to itself, as the end and scope of some desire, or other passion, in which case the thoughts are said to wander, and seem impertinent one to another, as in a dream. Such are commonly the thoughts of men, that are not only without company, but also without care of anything, though even then their thoughts are as busy as at other times, but without harmony, as the sound which a lute out of tune would yield to any man, or in tune, to one that could not play. And yet in this wild ranging of the mind, a man may oft-times perceive the way of it, and the dependence of one thought upon another. For in a discourse of our present civil war, what could seem more impertinent, than to ask, as one did, what was the value of a Roman penny? Yet the coherence to me was manifest enough. For the thought of the war, introduced the thought of the delivering up the king to his enemies, the thought of that, brought in the thought of the delivering up of Christ, and that again the thought of the 30 pence, which was the price of that treason, and thence easily followed that malicious question, and all this in a moment of time, for thought is quick. Train of thoughts regulated. The second is more constant, as being regulated by some desire, and designee. For the impression made by such things as we desire, or fear, is strong, and permanent, or, if it cease for a time, of quick return, so strong it is sometimes, as to hinder and break our sleep. From desire, ariseth the thought of some means we have seen produce the like of that which we aim at, and from the thought of that, the thought of means to that mean, and so continually, till we come to some beginning within our own power. And because the end, by the greatness of the impression, comes often to mind, in case our thoughts begin to wander, they are quickly again reduced into the way, which observed by one of the 7 wise men, made him give men this precept, which is now worn out, res pece finem, that is to say, in all your actions, look often upon what you would have, as the thing that directs all your thoughts in the way to attain it. Remembrance. The train of regulated thoughts is of two kinds, one of an effect imagined, we seek the causes, or means that produce it, and this is common to man and beast. The other is, when imagining anything whatsoever, we seek all the possible effects, that can by it be produced, that is to say, we imagine what we can do with it, when we have it. Of which I have not at any time seen any signa, but in man only, for this is a curiosity hardly incident to the nature of any living creature that has no other passion but sensual, such as are hunger, thirst, lust, and anger. In sum, the discourse of the mind, when it is governed by designee, is nothing but seeking, or the faculty of invention, which the Latins call sagacitas, and solertia, a hunting out of the causes, of some effect, present or past, or of the effects, of some present or past cause. Sometimes a man seeks what he hath lost, and from that place, and time, wherein he misses it, his mind runs back, from place to place, and time to time, to find where, and when he had it, that is to say, to find some certain, and limited time and place, in which to begin a method of seeking. Again, from thence, his thoughts run over the same places and times, to find what action, or other occasion might make him lose it. This we call remembrance, or calling to mind, the Latins call it reminiscentia, as it were a reconning of our former actions. Sometimes a man knows a place determinate, within the compass whereof is to seek, and then his thoughts run over all the parts thereof, in the same manner, as one would sweep a room, to find a jewel, or as a spaniel ranges the field, till he find a scent, or as a man should run over the alphabet, to start a rhyme. Prudence. Sometime a man desires to know the event of an action, and then he thinketh of some like action past, and the events thereof one after another, supposing like events will follow like actions. As he that foresees what will become of a criminal, recons what he has seen follow on the like crime before, having this order of thoughts, the crime, the officer, the prison, the judge, and the gallows. Which kind of thoughts, is called foresight, and prudence, or providence, and sometimes wisdom, though such conjecture, through the difficulty of observing all circumstances, be very fallacious. But this is certain, by how much one man has more experience of things past, than another, by so much also he is more prudent, and his expectations the seldomer fail him. The present only has a being in nature, things past have a being in the memory only, but things to come have no being at all, the future being but a fiction of the mind, applying the sequels of actions past, to the actions that are present, which with most certainty is done by him that is most experienced, but not with certainty enough. And though it be called prudence, when the event answereth our expectation, yet in its own nature, it is but presumption. For the foresight of things to come, which is providence, belongs only to him by whose will they are to come. From him only, and supernaturally, proceeds prophecy. The best prophet naturally is the best guesser, and the best guesser, he that is most versed and studied in the matters he guesses at, for he hath most signia to guess by. Signia. A signa, is the event antecedent, of the consequent, and contrarily, the consequent of the antecedent, when the like consequences have been observed, before, and the oftener they have been observed, the less uncertain is the signa. And therefore he that is most experienced in any kind of business, has most signia, whereby to guess at the future time, and consequently is the most prudent, and so much more prudent than he that is new in that kind of business, as not to be equaled by any advantage of natural and extemporary wit, though perhaps many young men think the contrary. Nevertheless it is not prudence that distinguisheth man from beast. There be beasts, that at a year old observe more, and pursue that which is for their good, more prudently, than a child can do at 10. Conjecture of the time past. As prudence is a presumption of the future, contracted from the experience of time past, so there is a presumption of things past taken from other things, not future but, past also. For he that hath seen by what courses and degrees, a flourishing state hath first come into civil war, and then to ruin, upon the sights of the ruin of any other state, will guess, the like war, and the like courses have been there also. But his conjecture, has the same uncertainty almost with the conjecture of the future, both being grounded only upon experience. There is no other act of man's mind, that I can remember, naturally planted in him, so, as to need no other thing, to the exercise of it, but to be born a man, and live with the use of his five senses. Those other faculties, of which I shall speak by and by, and which seem proper to man only, are acquired, and increased by study and industry, and of most men learned by instruction, and discipline, and proceed all from the invention of words, and speech. For besides sense, and thoughts, and the train of thoughts, the mind of man has no other motion, though by the help of speech, and method, the same faculties may be improved to such a height, as to distinguish man from all other living creatures. Whatsoever we imagine, is finite. Therefore there is no idea, or conception of anything we call infinite. No man can have in his mind an image of infinite magnitude, nor can see the ends, and bounds of the thing named, having no conception of the thing, but of our own inability. And therefore the name of God is used, not to make us conceive him, for he is incomprehensible, and his greatness, and power are unconceivable, but that we may honor him. Also because whatsoever, as I said before, we conceive, has been perceived first by sense, either all at once, or by parts, a man can have no thought, representing anything, not subject to sense. No man therefore can conceive anything, but he must conceive it in some place, and endued with some determinate magnitude, and which may be divided into parts, nor that anything is all in this place, and all in another place at the same time, nor that two, or more things can be in one, and the same place at once, for none of these things ever have, or can be incident to sense, but are absurd speeches, taken upon credit, without any signification at all, from deceived philosophers, and deceived, or deceiving schoolmen. Chapter 4. Of Speech. Original of Speech. The invention of printing, though ingenious, compared with the invention of letters, is no great matter. But who was the first that found the use of letters, is not known. He that first brought them into Greece, men say was Cadmus, the son of Agenor, king of Phoenicia. A profitable invention for continuing the memory of time past, and the conjunction of mankind, dispersed into so many, and distant regions of the earth, and withal difficult, as proceeding from a watchful observation of the divers motions of the tongue, palate, lips, and other organs of speech, whereby to make as many differences of characters, to remember them. But the most noble and profitable invention of all other, was that of speech, consisting of names or appellations, and their connection, whereby men register their thoughts, recall them when they are past, and also declare them one to another for mutual utility and conversation, without which, there had been amongst men, neither commonwealth, nor society, nor contract, nor peace, no more than amongst lions, bears, and wolves. The first author of speech was God himself, that instructed Adam how to name such creatures as he presented to his sight, for the scripture goeth no further in this matter. But this was sufficient to direct him to utter more names, as the experience and use of the creatures should give him occasion, and to join them in such manner by degrees, as to make himself understood, and so by succession of time, so much language might be gotten, as he had found use for, though not so copious, as an orator or philosopher has need of. For I do not find anything in the scripture, out of which, directly or by consequence can be gathered, that Adam was taught the names of all figures, numbers, measures, colors, sounds, fancies, relations, much less the names of words and speech, as general, special, affirmative, negative, interrogative, optative, infinitive, all which are useful, and least of all, of entity, intentionally, quiddity, and other significant words of the school. But all this language gotten, and augmented by Adam and his posterity, was again lost at the Tower of Babel, when by the hand of God, every man was stricken for his rebellion, with an oblivion of his former language. And being hereby forced to disperse themselves into several parts of the world, it must needs be, that the diversity of tongues that now is, proceeded by degrees from them, in such manner, as need, the mother of all inventions, taught them, and in tract of time grew everywhere more copious. The use of speech. The general use of speech, is to transfer our mental discourse, into verbal, or the train of our thoughts, into a train of words, and that for two commodities, whereof one is, the registering of the consequences of our thoughts, which being apt to slip out of our memory, and put us to a new labor, may again be recalled, by such words as they were marked by. So that the first use of names, is to serve for marks, or notes of remembrance. Another is, when many use the same words, to signify, by their connection and order, one to another, what they conceive, or think of each matter, and also what they desire, fear, or have any other passion for, and for this use they are called signa. Special uses of speech are these: first, to register, what by cogitation, we find to be the cause of anything, present or past, and what we find things present or past may produce, or effect, which in some, is acquiring of arts. Secondly, to show to others that knowledge which we have attained, which is, to counsel, and teach one another. Thirdly, to make known to others our wills, and purposes, that we may have the mutual help of one another. Fourthly, to please and delight ourselves, and others, by playing with our words, for pleasure or ornament, innocently. Abuses of speech. To these uses, there are also four correspondent abuses. First, when men register their thoughts wrong, by the inconstancy of the signification of their words, by which they register for their conceptions, that which they never conceived, and so deceive themselves. Secondly, when they use words metaphorically, that is, in other sense than that they are ordained for, and thereby deceive others. Thirdly, when by words they declare that to be their will, which is not. Fourthly, when they use them to grieve one another, for seeing nature hath armed living creatures, some with teeth, some with horns, and some with hands, to grieve an enemy, it is but an abuse of speech, to grieve him with the tongue, unless it be one whom we are obliged to govern, and then it is not to grieve, but to correct and amend. The manner how speech serveth to the remembrance of the consequence of causes and effects, consisteth in the imposing of names, and the connection of them. Names proper and common universal. Of names, some are proper, and singular to one only thing, as Peter, John, this man, this tree, And some are common to many things, as man, horse, tree, every of which though but one name, is nevertheless the name of divers particular things, in respect of all which together, it is called an universal, there being nothing in the world universal but names, for the things named, are every one of them individual and singular. One universal name is imposed on many things, for their similitude in some quality, or other accident, and whereas a proper name bringeth to mind one thing only, universals recall any one of those many. And of names universal, some are of more, and some of less extent, the larger comprehending the less large, and some again of equal extent, comprehending each other reciprocally. As for example, the name body is of larger signification than the word man, and comprehendeth it, and the names man and rational, are of equal extent, comprehending mutually one another. But here we must take notice, that by a name is not always understood, as in grammar, one only word, but sometimes by circumlocution many words together. For all these words, he that in his actions observeth the laws of his country, make but one name, equivalent to this one word, just. By this imposition of names, some of larger, some of stricter signification, we turn the reckoning of the consequences of things imagined in the mind, into a reckoning of the consequences of appellations. For example, a man that hath no use of speech at all, such, as is born and remains perfectly deaf and dumb, if he set before his eyes a triangle, and by a two right angles, such as are the corners of a square figure, he may by meditation compare and find, that the three angles of that triangle, are equal to those two right angles that stand by it. But if another triangle be shown him different in shape from the former, he cannot know without a new labor, whether the three angles of it also be equal to the same. But he that hath the use of words, when he observes, that such a quality was consequent, not to the length of the sides, nor to any other particular thing in his triangle, but only to this, that the sides were straight, and the angles three, and that that was all, for which he named it a triangle, will boldly conclude universally, that such a quality of angles is in all triangles whatsoever, and register his invention in these general terms, every triangle hath its three angles equal to two right angles. And thus the consequence found in one particular, comes to be registered and remembered, as a universal rule, and discharges our mental reckoning, of time and place, and delivers us from all labor of the mind, saving the first, and makes that which was found true here, and now, to be true in all times and places. But the use of words in registering our thoughts, is in nothing so evident as in numbering. A natural fool that could never learn by heart the order of numeral words, as 1, 2, and 3, may observe every stroke of the clock, and nod to it, or say 1, 1, 1, but can never know what hour it strikes. And it seems, there was a time when those names of number were not in use, and men were fain to apply their fingers of one or both hands, to those things they desired to keep account of, and that thence it proceeded, that now our numeral words are but 10, in any nation, and in some but 5, and then they begin again. And he that can tell 10, if he recite them out of order, will lose himself, and not know when he has done, much less will he be able to add, and subtract, and perform all other operations of arithmetic. So that without words, there is no possibility of reckoning of numbers, much less of magnitudes, of swiftness, of force, and other things, the reckonings whereof are necessary to the being, or well-being of mankind. When two names are joined together into a consequence, or affirmation, as thus, a man is a living creature, or thus, if he be a man, he is a living creature, if the later name living creature, signify all that the former name man signifieth, then the affirmation, or consequence is true, otherwise false. For true and false are attributes of speech, not of things. And where speech and not, there is neither truth nor falsehood. Or there may be, as when we expect that which shall not be, or suspect what has not been, but in neither case can a man be charged with untruth. Seeing then that truth consisteth in the right ordering of names in our affirmations, a man that seeketh precise truth, had need to remember what every name he uses stands for, and to place it accordingly, or else he will find himself entangled in words, as a bird in limed wigs, the more he struggles, the more belimed. And therefore in geometry, which is the only science that it hath pleased God hitherto to bestow on mankind, men begin at settling the significations of their words, which settling of significations, they call definitions, and place them in the beginning of their reckoning. By this it appears how necessary it is for any man that aspires to true knowledge, to examine the definitions of former authors, and either to correct them, where they are negligently set down, or to make them himself. For the errors of definitions multiply themselves, according as the reckoning proceeds, and lead men into absurdities, which at last they see, but cannot avoid, without reckoning anew from the beginning, in which lies the foundation of their errors. From whence it happens, that they which trust to books, do as they that cast up many little sums into a greater, without considering whether those little sums were rightly cast up or not, and at last finding the error visible, and not mistrusting their first grounds, know not which way to clear themselves, but spend time in fluttering over their books, as birds that entering by the chimney, and finding themselves enclosed in a chamber, flitter at the false light of a glass window, for want of wit to consider which way they came in. So that in the right definition of names, lies the first use of speech, which is the acquisition of science, and in wrong, or no definitions lies the first abuse, from which proceed all false and senseless tenets, which make those men that take their instruction from the authority of books, and not from their own meditation, to be as much below the condition of ignorant men, as men endued with true science are above it. For between true science, and erroneous doctrines, ignorance is in the middle. Natural sense and imagination, are not subject to absurdity. Nature itself cannot err, and as men abound in copiousness of language, so they become more wise, or more mad than ordinary. Nor is it possible without letters for any man to become either excellently wise, or, unless his memory be hurt by disease, or ill constitution of organs, excellently foolish. For words are wise men's counters, they do but reckon by them, but they are the money of fools, that value them by the authority of an Aristotle, a Cicero, or a Thomas, or any other doctor whatsoever, if but a man. Subject to names. Subject to names, is whatsoever can enter into, or be considered in an account, and be added one to another to make a sum, or subtracted one from another, and leave a remainder. The Latins called accounts of moni rationes, and accounting, ratiocinatio, and that which we in bills or books of account call items, they called nomina, that is, names, and thence it seems to proceed, that they extended the word ratio, to the faculty of reckoning in all other things. The Greeks have but one word logos, for both speech and reason, not that they thought there was no speech without reason, but no reasoning without speech, and the act of reasoning they called syllogism, which significeth summing up of the consequences of one saying to another. And because the same things may enter into account for divers accidents, their names are, to show that diversity, diversely rested, and diversified. This diversity of names may be reduced to four general heads. First, a thing may enter into account for matter, or body, as living, sensible, rational, hot, cold, moved, quiet, with all which names the word matter, or body is understood, all such, being names of matter. Secondly, it may enter into account, or be considered, for some accident or quality, which we conceive to be in it, as for being moved, for being so long, for being hot, and see, and then, of the name of the thing itself, by a little change or resting, we make a name for that accident, which we consider, and for living put into account life, for moved, motion, for hot, heat, for long, length, and the like. And all such names, are the names of the accidents and properties, by which one matter, and body is distinguished from another. These are called names abstract, because severed, not from matter, but, from the account of matter. Thirdly, we bring into account, the properties of our own bodies, whereby we make such distinction, as when anything is seen by us, we reckon not the thing itself, but the sight, the color, the idea of it in the fancy, and when anything is heard, we reckon it not, but the hearing, or sound only, which is our fancy or conception of it by the ear, and such are names of fancies. Fourthly, we bring into account, consider, and give names, to names themselves, and to speeches, for, general, universal, special, equivocal, are names of names. An affirmation, interrogation, common one, narration, syllogism, sermon, oration, and many other such, are names of speeches. Use of names positive. And this is all the variety of names positive, which are put to mark somewhat which is in nature, or may be feigned by the mind of man, as bodies that are, or may be conceived to be, or of bodies, the properties that are, or may be feigned to be, or words and speech. Negative names with their uses. There be also other names, called negative, which are notes to signify that a word is not the name of a thing in question, as these words nothing, no man, infinite, indocible, 314, and the like, which are nevertheless of use in reckoning, or in correcting of reckoning, and call to mind our past cogitations, though they be not names of anything, because they make us refuse to admit of names not rightly used. Words insignificant. All other names are but insignificant sounds, and those of two sorts. One, when they are new, and yet their meaning not explained by definition, whereof there have been abundance coined by schoolmen, and pus-led philosophers. Another, when men make a name of two names, whose significations are contradictory and inconsistent, as this name, an incorporeal body, or, which is all one, an incorporeal substance, and a great number more. For whensoever any affirmation is false, the two names of which it is composed, put together and made one, signify nothing at all. For example, if it be a false affirmation to say a quadrangle is round, the word round quadrangle signifies nothing, but is a mere sound. So likewise if it be false, to say that virtue can be powered, or blown up and down, the words in powered virtue, in blown virtue, are as absurd and insignificant, as a round quadrangle. And therefore you shall hardly meet with a senseless and insignificant word, that is not made up of some Latin or Greek names. A Frenchman seldom hears our Savior called by the name of parole, but by the name of verb often, yet verb and parole differ no more, but that one is Latin, the other French. Understanding. When a man upon the hearing of any speech, hath those thoughts which the words of that speech, and their connection, were ordained and constituted to signify, then he is said to understand it, understanding being nothing else, but conception caused by speech. And therefore if speech be peculiar to man, as for aught I know it is, then is understanding peculiar to him also. And therefore of absurd and false affirmations, in case they be universal, there can be no understanding, though many think they understand, then, when they do but repeat the words softly, or con them in their mind. What kinds of speeches signify the appetites, aversions, and passions of man's mind, and of their use and abuse, I shall speak when I have spoken of the passions. Inconstant names. The names of such things as affect us, that is, which please, and displease us, because all men be not alike affected with the same thing, nor the same man at all times, are in the common discourses of men, of inconstant signification. For seeing all names are imposed to signify our conceptions, and all our affections are but conceptions, when we conceive the same things differently, we can hardly avoid different naming of them. For though the nature of that we conceive, be the same, yet the diversity of our reception of it, in respect of different constitutions of body, and prejudices of opinion, gives everything a tincture of our different passions. And therefore in reasoning, a man must take heed of words, which besides the signification of what we imagine of their nature, disposition, and interest of the speaker, such as are the names of virtues, and vices, for one man calleth wisdom, what another calleth fear, and one cruelty, what another justice, one prodigality, what another magnanimity, one gravity, what another stupidity, and see. And therefore such names can never be true grounds of any ratiocination. No more can metaphors, and tropes of speech, but these are less dangerous, because they profess their inconstancy, which the other do not. Chapter 5. Of Reason, and Science. Reason what it is. When a man reasoneth, he does nothing else but conceive a sum total, from addition of parcels, or conceive a remainder, from subtraction of one sum from another, which, if it be done by words, is conceiving of the consequence of the names of all the parts, to the name of the whole, or from the names of the whole in one part, to the name of the other part. And though in some things, as in numbers, besides adding and subtracting, men name other operations, as multiplying and dividing, yet they are the same, for multiplication, is but addition together of things equal, and division, but subtracting of one thing, as often as we can. These operations are not incident to numbers only, but to all manner of things that can be added together, and taken one out of another. For as arithmeticians teach to add and subtract in numbers, so the geometricians teach the same in lines, figures, solid and superficial, angles, proportions, times, degrees of swiftness, force, power, and the like. The logicians teach the same in consequences of words, adding together two names, to make an affirmation, and two affirmations, to make a syllogism, and many syllogisms to make a demonstration, and from the sum, or conclusion of a syllogism, they subtract one proposition, to find a the other. Writers of politique, audit together passions, to find men's duties, and lawyers, laws and facts, to find what is right and wrong in the actions of private men. In sum, in what matter soever there is place for addition and subtraction, there also is place for a reason, and where these have no place, their reason has nothing at all to do. Reason defined. Out of all which we may define, that is to say determine, what that is, which is meant by this word reason, when we reckon it amongst the faculties of the mind. For reason, in this sense, is nothing but reckoning, that is, adding and subtracting, of the consequences of general names agreed upon, for the marking and signifying of our thoughts, I say marking them, when we reckon by ourselves, and signifying, when we demonstrate, or prove our reckonings to other men. Right reason where? And as in arithmetic, unpracticed men must, and professors themselves may often err, and cast up false, so also in any other subject of reasoning, the ablest, most attentive, and most practiced men, may deceive themselves, and infer false conclusions, not but that reason itself is always right reason, as well as arithmetic is a certain and infallible art, but no one man's reason, nor the reason of any one number of men, makes the certainty, no more than an account is therefore well cast up, because a great many men have unanimously approved it. And therefore, as when there is a controversy in an account, the parties must by their own accord, set up for right reason, the reason of some arbitrator, or judge, to whose sentence they will both stand, or their controversy must either come to blows, or be undecided, for one of a right reason constituted by nature, so is it also in all debates of what kind soever, and when men that think themselves wiser than all others, clamor and demand right reason for judge, yet seek no more, but that things should be determined, by no other men's reason but their own, it is as intolerable in the society of men, as it is in play after trump is turned, to use for trump on every occasion, that sweet whereof they have most in their hand. For they do nothing else, that will have every of their passions, as it comes to bear sway in them, to be taken for right reason, and that in their own controversies, bewraying their want of right reason, by the claim they lay to it. The use of reason. The use and end of reason, is not the finding of the sum, and truth of one, or a few consequences, remote from the first definitions, and settled significations of names, but to begin at these, and proceed from one consequence to another. For there can be no certainty of the last conclusion, without a certainty of all those affirmations and negations, on which it was grounded, and inferred. As when a master of a family, in taking an account, casteth up the sums of all the bills of expense, into one sum, and not regarding how each bill is summed up, by those that give them an account, nor what it is he pays for, he advantages himself no more, than if he allowed the account in grossa, trusting to every of the accountant's skill and honesty, so also in reasoning of all other things, he that takes up conclusions on the trust of authors, and doth not fetch them from the first items in every reckoning, which are the significations of names settled by definitions, loses his labor, and does not know anything, but wanly believeth. Of error and absurdity. When a man reckons without the use of words, which may be done in particular things, as when upon the sight of any one thing, we conjecture what was likely to have preceded, or is likely to follow upon it, if that which he thought likely to follow, follow is not, or that which he thought likely to have preceded it, hath not preceded it, this is called error, to which even the most prudent men are subject. But when we reason in words of general signification, and fall upon a general inference which is false, though it be commonly called error, it is indeed an absurdity, or senseless speech. For error is but a deception, in presuming that somewhat is past, or to come, of which, though it were not past, or not to come, yet there was no impossibility discoverable. But when we make a general assertion, unless it be a true one, the possibility of it is unconceivable. And words whereby we conceive nothing but the sound, are those we call absurd, insignificant, and nonsense. And therefore if a man should talk to me of a round quadrangle, or accidents of bread and cheese, or immaterial substances, or of a free subject, a free will, or any free, but free from being hindered by opposition, I should not say he were in an error, but that his words were without meaning, that is to say, absurd. I have said before, in the second chapter, that a man did excel all other animals in this faculty, that when he conceived anything whatsoever, he was apt to inquire the consequences of it, and what effects he could do with it. And now I ought to this other degree of the same excellence, that he can by words reduce the consequences he finds to general rules, called theorems, or aphorisma, that is, he can reason, or reckon, not only in number, but in all other things, whereof one may be added unto, or subtracted from another. But this privilege, is allayed by another, and that is, by the privilege of absurdity, to which no living creature is subject, but man only. And of men, those are of all most subject to it, that profess philosophy. For it is most true that Cicero saith of them somewhere, that there can be nothing so absurd, but may be found in the books of philosophers. And the reason is manifest. For there is not one of them that begins his ratiocination from the definitions, or explications of the names they are to use, which is a method that hath been used only in geometry, whose conclusions have thereby been made indisputable. Causes of absurdity. The first cause of absurd conclusions I ascribe to the one of method, in that they begin not their ratiocination from definitions, that is, from settled significations of their words, as if they could cast account, without knowing the value of the numeral words, 1, 2, and 3. And whereas all bodies enter into account upon divers considerations, which I have mentioned in the precedent chapter, these considerations being diversely named, divers absurdities proceed from the confusion, and unfit connection of their names into assertions. And therefore, the second cause of absurd assertions, I ascribe to the giving of names of bodies, to accidents, or of accidents, to bodies, as they do, that say, faith is infused, or inspired, when nothing can be powered, or breathed into anything, but body, and that, extension is body, that phantasms are spirits, and see. The third I ascribe to the giving of the names of the accidents of bodies without us, to the accidents of our own bodies, as they do that say, the color is in the body, the sound is in the air, and see. The fourth, to the giving of the names of bodies, to names, or speeches, as they do that say, that there be things universal, that a living creature is genus, or a general thing, and see. The fifth, to the giving of the names of accidents, to names and speeches, as they do that say, the nature of a thing is in its definition, a man's command is his will, and the like. The sixth, to the use of metaphors, tropes, and other rhetorical figures, instead of words proper. For though it be lawful to say, for example, in common speech, the way goeth, or leadeth hither, or thither, the proverb says this or that, whereas ways cannot go, nor proverbs speak, yet in reckoning, and seeking of truth, such speeches are not to be admitted. The seventh, to names that signify nothing, but are taken up, and learned by rote from the schools, as hypostatical, transubstantiate, consubstantiate, eternal now, and the like canting of schoolmen. To him that can avoid these things, it is not easy to fall into any absurdity, unless it be by the length of an account, wherein he may perhaps forget what went before. For all men by nature reason alike, and well, when they have good principles. For who is so stupid, as both to mistake in geometry, and also to persist in it, when another detects his error to him? Science. By this it appears that reason is not a sense, and memory, born with us, nor gotten by experience only, as prudence is, but attained by industry, first in apt imposing of names, and secondly by getting a good and orderly method in proceeding from the elements, which are names, to assertions made by connection of one of them to another, and so to syllogisms, which are the connections of one assertion to another, till we come to a knowledge of all the consequences of names appertaining to the subject in hand, and that is it, men call science. And whereas sense and memory are but knowledge of fact, which is a thing past, and irrevocable, science is the knowledge of consequences, and dependence of one fact upon another, by which, out of that we can presently do, we know how to do something else when we will, or the like, another time, because when we see how anything comes about, upon what causes, and by what manner, when the like causes come into our power, we see how to make it produce the like effects. Children therefore are not endued with reason at all, till they have attained the use of speech, but are called reasonable creatures, for the possibility apparent of having the use of reason in time to come. And the most part of men, though they have the use of reasoning a little way, as in numbering to some degree, yet it serves them to little use in common life, in which they govern themselves, some better, some worse, according to their differences of experience, quickness of memory, and inclinations to several ends, but specially according to good or of ill fortune, and the errors of one another. For as for science, or certain rules of their actions, they are so far from it, that they know not what it is. Geometry they have thought conjuring, but for other sciences, they who have not been taught the beginnings, and some progress in them, that they may see how they be acquired and generated, are in this point like children, that having no thought of generation, are made believe by the women, that their brothers and sisters are not born, but found in the garden. But yet they that have no science, are in better, and nobler condition with their natural prudence, than men, that by misreasoning, or by trusting them that reason wrong, fall upon false and absurd general rules. For ignorance of causes, and of rules, does not set men so far out of their way, as relying on false rules, and taking for causes of what they aspire to, those that are not so, but rather causes of the contrary. To conclude, the light of humane minds is perspicuous words, but by exact definitions first snuffed, and purged from ambiguity, reason is the pace, increase of science, the way, and the benefit of mankind, the end. And on the contrary, metaphors, and senseless and ambiguous words, are like ignes fatui, and reasoning upon them, is wandering amongst innumerable absurdities, and their end, contention, and sedition, or contempt. Prudence and sapience, with their difference. As, much experience, is prudence, so, is much science, sapience. For though we usually have one name of wisdom for them both, yet the Latins did always distinguish between prudentia and sapientia, ascribing the former to experience, the latter to science. But to make their difference appear more clearly, let us suppose one man endued with an excellent natural use, and dexterity in handling his arma, and another to have added to that dexterity, an acquired science, of where he can offend, or be offended by his adversary, in every possible posture, or guard. The ability of the former would be to the ability of the latter, as prudence to sapience, both useful, but the latter infallible. But they that trusting only to the authority of books, follow the blind blindly, are like him that trusting to the false rules of the master of fence, ventures presumptuously upon an adversary, that either kills, or disgraces him. Signia of science. The signia of science, are some, certain and infallible, some, uncertain. Certain, when he that pretendeth the science of anything, can teach the same, that is to say, demonstrate the truth thereof perspicuously to another, uncertain, when only some particular events answer to his pretense, and upon many occasions prove so as he says they must. Signia of prudence are all uncertain, because to observe by experience, and remember all circumstances that may alter the success, is impossible. But in any business, whereof a man has not infallible science to proceed by, to forsake his own natural judgment, and be guided by general sentences read in authors, and subject to many exceptions, is a signa of folly, and generally scorned by the name of pedantry. And even of those men themselves, that in councils of the commonwealth, love to show their reading of politique and history, very few do it in their domestic affairs, where their particular interest is concerned, having prudence enough for their private affairs, but in public they study more the reputation of their own wit, than the success of another's business. Chapter 6. Of the inner eye or beginnings of voluntary motions. Commonly called the passions. And the speeches by which they are expressed. Motion vital in animal. There be in animals, two sorts of motions peculiar to them, one called vital, begun in generation, and continued without interruption through their whole life, such as are the course of the blood, the pulse, the breathing, the concoctions, nutrition, excretion, and see, to which motions there needs no help of imagination, the other in animal motion, otherwise called voluntary motion, as to go, to speak, to move any of our lamba, in such manner as is first fancied in our minds. That sense, is motion in the organs and inner eye or parts of man's body, caused by the action of the things we see, hear, and see, and that fancy is but the relics of the same motion, remaining after sense, has been already cited in the first and second chapters. And because going, speaking, and the like voluntary motions, depend always upon a precedent thought of whither, which way, and what, it is evident, that the imagination is the first internal beginning of all voluntary motion. And although unstudied men, do not conceive any motion at all to be there, where the thing moved is invisible, or the space it is moved in, is, for the shortness of it, insensible, yet that doth not hinder, but that such motions are. For let a space be never so little, that which is moved over a greater space, whereof that little one is part, must first be moved over that. These small beginnings of motion, within the body of man, before they appear in walking, speaking, striking, and other visible actions, are commonly called endeavor. Endeavor, appetite, desire, hunger, thirst, aversion. This endeavor, when it is toward something which causes it, is called appetite, or desire, the latter, being the general name, and the other, oftentimes restrained to signify the desire of food, namely hunger and thirst. And when the endeavor is fromward something, it is generally called aversion. These words appetite, and aversion we have from the Latines, and they both of them signify the motions, one of approaching, the other of retiring. So also do the Greek words for the same, which are orm and affirm. For nature itself does often press upon men those truths, which afterwards, when they look for somewhat beyond nature, they stumble at. For the schools find in mere appetite to go, or move, no actual motion at all, but because some motion they must acknowledge, they call it metaphorical motion, which is but an absurd speech, for though words may be called metaphorical, bodies, and motions cannot. That which men desire, they are also signed to love, and to hate those things, for which they have aversion. So that desire, and love, are the same thing, save that by desire, we always signify the absence of the object, by love, most commonly the presence of the same. So also by aversion, we signify the absence, and by hate, the presence of the object. Of appetites, and aversions, some are born with men, as appetite of food, appetite of excretion, and exoneration, which may also and more properly be called aversions, from some what they feel in their bodies, and some other appetites, not many. The rest, which are appetites of particular things, proceed from experience, and try all of their effects upon themselves, or other men. For of things we know not at all, or believe not to be, we can have no further desire, than to taste and try. But aversion we have for things, not only which we know have hurt us, but also that we do not know whether they will hurt us, or not. Contempt. Those things which we neither desire, nor hate, we are said to contemn, contempt being nothing else but an immobility, or contumacy of the heart, in resisting the action of certain things, and proceeding from that the heart is already moved otherwise, by either more potent objects, or from one of experience of them. And because the constitution of a man's body is in continual mutation, it is impossible that all the same things should always cause in him the same appetites and aversions, much less can all men consent in the desire of almost any one and the same object. Good evil. But whatsoever is the object of any man's appetite or desire, that is it, which he for his part calleth good, and the object of his hate and aversion, evil, and of his contempt, vile and inconsiderable. For these words of good, evil, and contemptible, are ever used with relation to the person that useth them, there being nothing simply and absolutely so, nor any common rule of good and evil, to be taken from the nature of the objects themselves, but from the person of a man, where there is no commonwealth, or, in a commonwealth, from the person that representeth it, or from an arbitrator or judge, whom men disagreeing shall by consent set up, and make his sentence the rule thereof. Pulchrum turpi, delightful profitable, unpleasant unprofitable. The Latine tongue has two words, whose significations approach to those of good and evil, but are not precisely the same, and those are pulchrum and turpi. Whereof the former signifies that, which by some apparent senior promiseth good, and the later, that, which promiseth evil. But in our tongue we have not so general names to express them by. But for pulchrum, we say in some things, fair, in other beautiful, or handsome, or gallant, or honorable, or comely, or amiable, and for turpi, full, deformed, ugly, base, nauseous, and the like, as the subject shall require, all which words, in their proper places signify nothing else, but the mien, or countenance, that promiseth good and evil. So that of good there be three kinds, good in the promise, that is pulchrum, good in effect, as the end desired, which is called jucundum, delightful, and good as the means, which is called util, profitable, and as many of evil, for evil, in promise, is that they call turpi, evil in effect, and end, is molestum, unpleasant, troublesome, and evil in the means, in util, unprofitable, hurtful. Delight is pleasure. As, in sense, that which is really within us, is, as I have said before, one emotion, caused by the action of external objects, but in appearance, to the sight, light and color, to the ear, sound, to the nostril, odor, and see, so, when the action of the same object is continued from the eyes, ears, and other organs to the heart, the real effect there is nothing but motion, or endeavor, which consisteth in appetite, or aversion, to, or from the object moving. But the appearance, or sense of that motion, is that we either call delight, or trouble of mind. Pleasure offense. This motion, which is called appetite, and for the appearance of it delight, and pleasure, seemeth to be, a corroboration of vital motion, and a help thereunto, and therefore such things as cause delight, were not improperly called jucunda, adjuvando, from helping or fortifying, and the contrary, molesta, offensive, from hindering, and troubling the motion vital. Pleasure therefore, or delight, is the appearance, or sense of good, and molestation or displeasure, the appearance, or sense of evil. And consequently all appetite, desire, and love, is accompanied with some delight more or less, and all hatred, and aversion, with more or less displeasure and offense. Pleasures of sense, pleasures of the mind, joy, pain, grief. Of pleasures, or delights, some arise from the sense of an object present, and those may be called pleasures of sense, the word sensual, as it is used by those only that condemn them, having no place till there be laws. Of this kind are all wonerations and exonerations of the body, as also all that is pleasant, in the sight, hearing, smell, taste, or touch. Others arise from the expectation, that proceeds from foresight of the end, or consequence of things, whether those things in the sense please or displease, and these are pleasures of the mind of him that draweth those consequences, and are generally called joy. In a like manner, displeasures, are some in the sense, and called pain, others, in the expectation of consequences, and are called grief. These simple passions called appetite, desire, love, aversion, hate, joy, and grief, have their names for divers considerations diversified. As first, when they once exceed another, they are diversely called from the opinion men have of the likelihood of attaining what they desire. Secondly, from the object loved or hated. Thirdly, from the consideration of many of them together. Fourthly, from the alteration or succession itself. Hope for appetite with an opinion of attaining, is called hope. Despair the same, without such opinion, despair. Fear aversion, with opinion of hurt from the object, fear. Courage the same, with hope of avoiding that hurt by resistance, courage. Anger sudden courage, anger. Confidence constant hope, confidence of ourselves. Diffidence constant despair, diffidence of ourselves. Indignation anger for great hurt done to another, when we conceive the same to be done by injury, indignation. Benevolence desire of good to another, benevolence, goodwill, charity. If to man generally, good nature. Covetousness desire of riches, covetousness, a name used always in signification of blame, because men contending for them, are displeased with one another's attaining them, though the desire in itself, be to be blamed, or allowed, according to the means by which those riches are sought. Ambition desire of office, or precedence, ambition, a name used also in the worse sense, for the reason before mentioned. Pusillanimity desire of things that conduce but a little to our ends, and fear of things that are but of little hindrance, pusillanimity. Magnanimity contempt of little helps, and hindrances, magnanimity. Valor magnanimity, in danger of death, or wounds, valor, fortitude. Liberality magnanimity in the use of riches, liberality. Miserableness pusillanimity, in the same wretchedness, miserableness, or parsimony, as it is liked or disliked. Kindness a love of persons for society, kindness a. Natural lust love of persons for pleasing the sense only, natural lust. Luxury love of the same, acquired from rumination, that is imagination of pleasure past, luxury. The passion of love, jealousy love of one singularly, with desire to be singularly beloved, the passion of love. The same, with fear that the love is not mutual, jealousy. Revengefulness desire, by doing hurt to another, to make him condemn some fact of his own, revengefulness. Curiosity desire, to know why, and how, curiosity, such as is in no living creature but man, so that man is distinguished, not only by his reason, but also by this singular passion from other animals, in whom the appetite of food, and other pleasures of sense, by predominance, take away the care of knowing causes, which is a lust of the mind, that by a perseverance of delight in the continual and indefatigable generation of knowledge, exceedeth the short vehemence of any carnal pleasure. Religion superstition, true religion fear of power invisible, feigned by the mind, or imagined from tales publicly allowed, religion, not allowed, superstition. And when the power imagined is truly such as we imagine, true religion. Panicter or fear, without the apprehension of why, or what, panic terror, called so from the fables that make Pan the author of them, whereas in truth there is always in him that so feareth, first, some apprehension of the cause, though the rest run away by example, every one supposing his fellow to know why. And therefore this passion happens to none but in a throng, or multitude of people. Admiration joy, from apprehension of novelty, admiration, proper to man, because it excites the appetite of knowing the cause. Glory vain glory joy, arising from imagination of a man's own power and ability, is that exaltation of the mind which is called glorying, which, if grounded upon the experience of his own former actions, is the same with confidence, but if grounded on the flattery of others, or only supposed by himself, for delight in the consequences of it, is called vainglory, which name is properly given, because a well-grounded confidence begetteth attempt, whereas the supposing of power does not, and is therefore rightly called vain. Dejection grief, from opinion of one of power, is called dejection of mind. The vain glory which consisteth in the feigning or supposing of abilities in ourselves, which we know or not, is most incident to young men, and nourished by the histories or fictions of gallant persons, and is corrected oftentimes by age, and employment. Sudden glory laughter sudden glory, is the passion which maketh those grimaces called laughter, and is caused either by some sudden act of their own, that pleaseth them, or by the apprehension of some deformed thing in another, by comparison whereof they suddenly applaud themselves. And it is incident most to them, that are conscious of the fewest abilities in themselves, who are forced to keep themselves in their own favor, by observing the imperfections of other men. And therefore much laughter at the defects of others is a sign of pusillanimity. For of great minds, one of the proper works is, to help and free others from scorn, and compare themselves wanly with the most able. Sudden dejection weeping on the contrary, sudden dejection is the passion that causeth weeping, and is caused by such accidents, as suddenly take away some vehement hope, or some prop of their power, and they are most subject to it, that rely principally on helps external, such as are women, and children. Therefore, some weep for the loss of friends, others for their unkindness, others for the sudden stop made to their thoughts of revenge, by reconciliation. But in all cases, both laughter and weeping, are sudden motions, custom taking them both away. For no man laughs at old jests, or weeps for an old calamity. Shame blushing grief, for the discovery of some defect of ability is shame, or the passion that discovereth itself in blushing, and consisteth in the apprehension of something dishonorable, and in young men, is a signa of the love of good reputation, and commendable, in old men it is a signa of the same, but because it comes too late, not commendable. Impudence the contempt of good reputation is called impudence. Pity grief, for the calamity of another is pity, and ariseth from the imagination that the like calamity may befall himself, and therefore is called also compassion, and in the phrase of this present time a fellow feeling, and therefore for calamity arriving from great wickedness, the best men have the least pity, and for the same calamity, those have least pity, that think themselves least obnoxious to the same. Cruelty contempt, or little sense of the calamity of others, is that which men call cruelty, proceeding from security of their own fortune. For, that any man should take pleasure in other men's great harms, without other end of his own, I do not conceive it possible. Emulation envy grief, for the success of a competitor in wealth, honor, or other good, if it be joined with endeavor to enforce our own abilities to equal or exceed him, is called emulation, but joined with endeavor to supplant or hinder a competitor, envy. Deliberation when in the mind of man, appetites and aversions, hopes and fears, concerning one and the same thing, arise alternately, and divers good and evil consequences of the doing, or omitting the thing propounded, come successively into our thoughts, so that sometimes we have an appetite to it, sometimes an aversion from it, sometimes hope to be able to do it, sometimes despair, or fear to attempt it. The whole sum of desires, aversions, hopes, and fears, continued till the thing be either done, or thought impossible, is that we call deliberation. Therefore if things past, there is no deliberation, because manifestly impossible to be changed, nor of things known to be impossible, or thought so, because men know, or think such deliberation vain. But of things impossible, which we think possible, we may deliberate, not knowing it is in vain. And it is called deliberation, because it is a putting an end to the liberty we had of doing, or omitting, according to our own appetite, or aversion. This alternate succession of appetites, aversions, hopes and fears is no less in other living creatures than in man, and therefore beasts also deliberate. Every deliberation is thence eyed to end when that whereof they deliberate, is either done, or thought impossible, because till then we retain the liberty of doing, or omitting, according to our appetite, or aversion. The will. In deliberation, the last appetite, or aversion, immediately adhering to the action, or to the omission thereof, is that we call the will, the act, not the faculty, of willing. And beasts that have deliberation must necessarily also have will. The definition of the will, given commonly by the schools, that it is a rational appetite, is not good. For if it were, then could there be no voluntary act against reason. For a voluntary act is that, which proceedeth from the will, and no other. But if instead of a rational appetite, we shall say an appetite resulting from a precedent deliberation, then the definition is the same that I have given here. Will, therefore, is the last appetite in deliberating. And though we say in common discourse, a man had a will once to do a thing, that nevertheless he forbore to do, yet that is properly but an inclination, which makes no action voluntary, because the action depends not of it, but of the last inclination, or appetite. For if the intervening appetites make any action voluntary, then by the same reason all intervenient aversions should make the same action involuntary, and so one and the same action should be both voluntary and involuntary. By this it is manifest, that not only actions that have their beginning from covetousness, ambition, lust, or other appetites to the thing propounded, but also those that have their beginning from aversion, or fear of those consequences that follow the omission, are voluntary actions. Forms of speech, in passion. The forms of speech by which the passions are expressed, are partly the same, and partly different from those, by which we express our thoughts. And first generally all passions may be expressed indicatively, as, I love, I fear, I joy, I deliberate, I will, I command, but some of them have particular expressions by themselves, which nevertheless are not affirmations, unless it be when they serve to make other inferences, besides that of the passion they proceed from. Deliberation is expressed subjunctively, which is a speech proper to signify suppositions, with their consequences, as, if this be done, then this will follow, and differs not from the language of reasoning, save that reasoning is in general words, but deliberation for the most part is of particulars. The language of desire, and aversion, is imperative, as, do this, forbear that, which when the party is obliged to do, or forbear, is command, otherwise prayer, or else counsel. The language of vainglory, of indignation, pity, and revengefulness, optative, but of the desire to know, there is a peculiar expression called interrogative, as, what is it, when shall it, how is it done, and why so? Other language of the passions I find none, for cursing, swearing, reviling, and the like, do not signify a speech, but as the actions of a tongue accustomed. These forms of speech, I say, are expressions, or voluntary significations of our passions, but certain senia they be not, because they may be used arbitrarily, whether they that use them, have such passions or not. The best senia of passions present, are either in the countenance, motions of the body, actions, and ends, or aims, which we otherwise know the man to have. Good and evil apparent. And because in deliberation the appetites and aversions are raised by foresight of the good and evil consequences, and sequels of the action whereof we deliberate, the good or evil effect thereof dependeth on the foresight of a long chain of consequences, of which very seldom any man is able to see to the end. But for so far as a man seeth, if the good in those consequences be greater than the evil, the whole chain is that which writers call apparent or seeming good. And contrarily, when the evil exceedeth the good, the whole is apparent or seeming evil, so that he who hath by experience, or reason, the greatest and surest prospect of consequences, deliberates best himself, and is able, when he will, to give the best counsel unto others. Felicity. Continual success in obtaining those things which a man from time to time desireth, that is to say, continual prospering, is that men call felicity, I mean the felicity of this life. For there is no such thing as perpetual tranquility of mind, while we live here, because life itself is but motion, and can never be without desire, nor without fear, no more than without sense. What kind of felicity God hath ordained to them that devoutly honor him, a man shall no sooner know, than enjoy, being joys, that now are as incomprehensible, as the word of schoolmen, beatifical vision, is unintelligible. Praise magnification. The form of speech whereby men signify their opinion of the goodness of anything is praise. That whereby they signify the power and greatness of anything is magnifying. And that whereby they signify the opinion they have of a man's felicity is by the Greeks called makarismos, for which we have no name in our tongue. And thus much is sufficient for the present purpose to have been said of the passions. Chapter 7. Of the ends or resolutions of discourse. Of all discourse, governed by desire of knowledge, there is at last an end, either by attaining, or by giving over. And in the chain of discourse, wheresoever it be interrupted, there is an end for that time. Judgment, or sentence final, doubt. If the discourse be merely mental, it consisteth of thoughts that the thing will be, and will not be, or that it has been, and has not been, alternately. So that wheresoever you break off the chain of a man's discourse, you leave him in a presumption of it will be, or, it will not be, or it has been, or, has not been. All which is opinion. And that which is alternate appetite, in deliberating concerning good and evil, the same is alternate opinion in the inquiry of the truth of past, and future. And as the last appetite in deliberation is called the will, so the last opinion in search of the truth of past, and future, is called the judgment, or resolute and final sentence of him that discourseth. And as the whole chain of appetites alternate, in the question of good or bad is called deliberation, so the whole chain of opinions alternate, in the question of true, or false is called doubt. No discourse whatsoever, can end in absolute knowledge of fact, past, or to come. For, as for the knowledge of fact, it is originally, sense, and ever after, memory. And for the knowledge of consequence, which I have said before is called science, it is not absolute, but conditional. No man can know by discourse, that this, or that, is, has been, or will be, which is to know absolutely, but onely, that if this be, that is, if this has been, that has been, if this shall be, that shall be, which is to know conditionally, and that not the consequence of one thing to another, but of one name of a thing, to another name of the same thing. Science, opinion, conscience. And therefore, When the discourse is put into speech, and begins with the definitions of words, and proceeds by connection of the same into general affirmations, and of these again into syllogisms, the end or last sum is called the conclusion, and the thought of the mind by it signified is that conditional knowledge, or knowledge of the consequence of words, which is commonly called science. But if the first ground of such discourse be not definitions, or if the definitions be not rightly joined together into syllogisms, then the end or conclusion is again opinion, namely of the truth of somewhat said, though sometimes in absurd and senseless words, without possibility of being understood. When two, or more men, know of one and the same fact, they are said to be conscious of it one to another, which is as much as to know it together. And because such are fittest witnesses of the facts of one another, or of a third, it was, and ever will be reputed a very evil act, for any man to speak against his conscience, or to corrupt or force another so to do, insomuch that the plea of conscience, has been always hearkened unto very diligently in all times. Afterwards, men made use of the same word metaphorically, for the knowledge of their own secret facts, and secret thoughts, and therefore it is rhetorically said that the conscience is a thousand witnesses. And last of all, men, vehemently in love with their own new opinions, though never so absurd, and obstinately bent to maintain them, gave those their opinions also that reverenced name of conscience, as if they would have it seem unlawful, to change or speak against them, and so pretend to know they are true, when they know at most but that they think so. Belief faith. When a man's discourse beginneth not at definitions, it beginneth either at some other contemplation of his own, and then it is still called opinion, or it beginneth at some saying of another, of whose ability to know the truth, and of whose honesty in not deceiving, he doubteth not, and then the discourse is not so much concerning the thing, as the person, and the resolution is called belief, and faith, faith, in the man, belief, both of the man, and of the truth of what he says. So then in belief are two opinions, one of the saying of the man, the other of his virtue. To have faith in, or trust to, or believe a man, signify the same thing, namely, an opinion of the veracity of the man, but to believe what is said, signifieth only an opinion of the truth of the saying. But we are to observe that this phrase, I believe in, as also the Latine, credo in, and the Greek, pisteno eis, are never used but in the writings of divines. Instead of them, in other writings are put, I believe him, I have faith in him, I rely on him, and in Latin, credo illi, fido illi, and in Greek, pisteno anto, and that this singularity of the ecclesiastical use of the word hath raised many disputes about the right object of the Christian faith. But by believing in, as it is in the creed, is meant, not trust in the person, but confession and acknowledgement of the doctrine. For not only Christians, but all manner of men do so believe in God, as to hold all for truth they hear him say, whether they understand it, or not, which is all the faith and trust can possibly be had in any person whatsoever, but they do not all believe the doctrine of the creed. From whence we may infer, that when we believe any saying whatsoever it be, to be true, from arguments taken, not from the thing itself, or from the principles of natural reason, but from the authority, and good opinion we have, of him that hath said it, then is the speaker, or person we believe in, or trust in, and whose word we take, the object of our faith, and the honor done in believing, is done to him only. And consequently, when we believe that the Scriptures are the word of God, having no immediate revelation from God himself, our belief, faith, and trust is in the Church, whose word we take, and acquiesce therein. And they that believe that which a prophet relates unto them in the name of God, take the word of the prophet, do honor to him, and in him trust, and believe, touching the truth of what he relateth, whether he be a true, or a false prophet. And so it is also with all other history. For if I should not believe all that is written by historians, of the glorious acts of Alexander, or Caesar, I do not think the ghost of Alexander, or Caesar, had any just cause to be offended, or anybody else, but the historian. If Livy say the gods made once a cow speak, and we believe it not, we distrust not God therein, but Livy. So that it is evident, that whatsoever we believe, upon no other reason, than what is drawn from authority of men only, and their writings, whether they be sent from God or not, is faith in men only. Chapter 8. Of the virtues commonly called intellectual. And their contrary defects. Intellectual virtu defined. Virtu generally, in all sorts of subjects, is somewhat that is valued for eminence, and consisteth in comparison. For if all things were equally in all men, nothing would be prized. And by virtues intellectual, are always understood such abilities of the mind, as men praise, value, and desire should be in themselves, and go commonly under the name of a good wit, though the same word wit, be used also, to distinguish one certain ability from the rest. Wit, natural, or acquired. These virtues are of two sorts, natural, and acquired. By natural, I mean not that which a man hath from his birth, for that is nothing else but sense, wherein men differ so little one from another, and from brute beasts, as it is not to be reckoned amongst virtues. But I mean, that wit, which is gotten by use only, and experience, without method, culture, or instruction. This natural wit, consisteth principally in two things, celerity of imagining, that is, swift succession of one thought to another, and steady direction to some approved end. On the contrary, a slow imagination, maketh that defect, or fault of the mind, which is commonly called dullness, stupidity, and sometimes by other names that signify slowness of motion, or difficulty to be moved. Good wit, or fancy, good judgment, discretion. And this difference of quickness, is caused by the difference of men's passions, that love and dislike, some one thing, some another, and therefore some men's thoughts run one way, some another, and are held to, and observe differently the things that pass through their imagination. And whereas in his succession of men's thoughts, there is nothing to observe in the things they think on, but either in what they be like one another, or in what they be unlike, or what they serve for, or how they serve to such a purpose, those that observe their similitudes, in case they be such as are but rarely observed by others, are said to have a good wit, by which, in this occasion, is meant a good fancy. But they that observe their differences, and dissimilitudes, which is called distinguishing, and discerning, and judging between thing and thing, in case such discerning be not easy, are said to have a good judgment, and particularly in matter of conversation and business, wherein times, places, and persons are to be discerned, this virtue is called discretion. The former, that is, fancy, without the help of judgment, is not commended as a virtue, but the latter, which is judgment, and discretion, is commended for itself, without the help of fancy. Besides the discretion of times, places, and persons, necessary to a good fancy, there is required also an often application of his thoughts to their end, that is to say, to some use to be made of them. This done, he that hath this virtue, will be easily fitted with similitudes, that will please, not only by illustration of his discourse, and adorning it with new and apt metaphors, but also, by the rarity or their invention. But without steadiness, and direction to some end, a great fancy is one kind of madness, such as they have, that entering into any discourse, are snatched from their purpose, by everything that comes in their thought, into so many, and so long digressions, and parentheses, that they utterly lose themselves, which kind of folly, I know no particular name for, but the cause of it is, sometimes want of experience, whereby that seemeth to a man new and rare, which doth not so to others, sometimes pusillanimity, by which that seems great to him, which other men think a trifle, and whatsoever is new, or great, and therefore thought fit to be told, withdraws a man by degrees from the intended way of his discourse. In a good poem, whether it be epic, or dramatique, as also in sonnets, epigrams, and other pieces, both judgment and fancy are required, but the fancy must be more eminent, because they please for the extravagancy, but ought not to displease by indiscretion. In a good history, the judgment must be eminent, because the goodness consisteth in the method, in the truth, and in the cause of the actions that are most profitable to be known. Fancy has no place, but only in adorning the style. In orations of praise, and in invectives, the fancy is predominant, because the design is not truth, but to honor or dishonor, which is done by noble, or by vile comparisons. The judgment does but suggest what circumstances make an action laudable, or culpable. In hortatives, and pleadings, as truth, or disguise serveth best of the design in hand, so is the judgment, or the fancy most required. In demonstration, in counsel, and all rigorous search of truth, judgment does all, except sometimes the understanding have need to be opened by some apt similitude, and then there is so much use of fancy. But for metaphors, they are in this case utterly excluded. For seeing they openly profess deceit, to admit them into counsel, or reasoning, were manifest folly. And in any discourse whatsoever, if the defect of discretion be apparent, how extravagant soever the fancy be, the whole discourse will be taken for a signal of want of wit, and so will it never when the discretion is manifest, though the fancy be never so ordinary. The secret thoughts of a man run over all things, holy, profane, clean, obscene, grave, and light, without shame, or blame, which verbal discourse cannot do, farther than the judgment shall approve of the time, place, and persons. An anatomist, or a physician may speak, or write his judgment of unclean things, because it is not to please, but profit, but for another man to write as extravagant and pleasant fancies of the same, is as if a man, from being tumbled into the dirt, should come and present himself before good company. And 'tis the want of discretion that makes the difference. Again, in professed remissness of mind, and familiar company, a man may play with the sounds and equivocal significations of words, and that many times with encounters of extraordinary fancy, but in a sermon, or in public, or before persons unknown, or whom we ought to reverence, there is no gingling of words that will not be accounted folly, and the difference is only in the want of discretion. So that where wit is wanting, it is not fancy that is wanting, but discretion. Judgment therefore without fancy is wit, but fancy without judgment not. Prudence. When the thoughts of a man, that has a design in hand, running over a multitude of things, observes how they conduce to that design, or what design they may conduce into, if his observations be such as are not easy, or usual, this wit of his is called prudence, and dependeth on much experience, and memory of the like things, and their consequences heretofore. In which there is not so much difference of men, as there is in their fancies and judgments, because the experience of men equal in age, is not much unequal, as to the quantity, but lies in different occasions, every one having his private designs. To govern well a family, and a kingdom, are not different degrees of prudence, but different sorts of business, no more than to draw a picture in little, or as great, or greater than the life, are different degrees of art. A plain husbandman is more prudent in affairs of his own house, than a privy counselor in the affairs of another man. Craft. To prudence, if you ought of the use of unjust, or dishonest means, such as usually are prompted to men by fear, or want, you have that crooked wisdom, which is called craft, which is a sign of pusillanimity. For magnanimity is contempt of unjust, or dishonest helps. And that which the Latins call versusia, translated into English, shifting, and is a putting off of a present danger or incommodity, by engaging into a greater, as when a man robs one to pay another, is but a shorter-sighted craft, called versusia, from versura, which signifies taking money at usury, for the present payment of interest. Acquired wit. As for acquired wit, I mean acquired by method and instruction, there is none but reason, which is grounded on the right use of speech, and produceth the sciences. But of reason and science, I have already spoken in the 5th and 6th chapters. The causes of this difference of wits, are in the passions, and the difference of passions, proceedeth partly from the different constitution of the body, and partly from different education. For if the difference proceeded from the temper of the brain, and the organs of sense, either exterior or interior, there would be no less difference of men in their sight, hearing, or other senses, than in their fancies, and discretions. It proceeds therefore from the passions, which are different, not only from the difference of men's complexions, but also from their difference of customs, and education. The passions that most of all cause the differences of wit, are principally, the more or less desire of power, of riches, of knowledge, and of honor. All which may be reduced to the first, that is desire of power. For riches, knowledge and honor are but several sorts of power. Giddiness and madness. And therefore, a man who has no great passion for any of these things, but is as men term it indifferent, though he may be so far a good man, as to be free from giving offense, yet he cannot possibly have either a great fancy, or much judgment. For the thoughts, are to the desires, as scouts, and spies, to range abroad, and find the way to the things desired, all steadiness of the mind's motion, and all quickness of the same, proceeding from thence. For as to have no desire, is to be dead, so to have weak passions, is dullness, and to have passions indifferently for everything, giddiness, and distraction, and to have stronger, and more vehement passions for anything, than is ordinarily seen in others, is that which men call madness. Whereof there be almost as many kinds, as of the passions themselves. Sometimes the extraordinary and extravagant passion, proceedeth from the evil constitution of the organs of the body, or harm done them, and sometimes the hurt, and indisposition of the organs, is caused by the vehemence, or long continuance of the passion. But in both cases the madness is of one and the same nature. The passion, whose violence, or continuance maketh madness, is either great vainglory, which is commonly called pride, and self-conceit, or great dejection of mind. Rage. Pride, subjecteth a man to anger, the excess whereof, is the madness called rage, and fury. And thus it comes to pass that excessive desire of revenge, when it becomes habitual, hurteth the organs, and becomes rage, that excessive love, with jealousy, becomes also rage, excessive opinion of a man's own self, for divine inspiration, for wisdom, learning, form, and the like, becomes distraction, and giddiness a, the same, joined with envy, rage, vehement opinion of the truth of anything, contradicted by others, rage. Melancholy. Dejection, subjects a man to causeless fears, which is a madness a commonly called melancholy, apparent also in divers manners, as in haunting of solitudes, and graves, in superstitious behavior, and in fearing some one, some another particular thing. In some, all passions that produce strange and unusual behavior, are called by the general name of madness. But of the several kinds of the madness, he that would take the pains, might enrol a legion. And if the excesses be madness, there is no doubt but the passions themselves, when they tend to evil, are degrees of the same. For example, though the effect of folly, in them that are possessed of an opinion of being inspired, be not visible always in one man, by any very extravagant action, that proceedeth from such passion, yet when many of them conspire together, the rage of the whole multitude is visible enough. For what argument of madness can there be greater, than to clamor, strike, and throw stones at our best friends? Yet this is somewhat less than such a multitude will do. For they will clamor, fight against, and destroy those, by whom all their lifetime before, they have been protected, and secured from injury. And if this be madness in the multitude, it is the same in every particular man. For as in the midst of the sea, though a man perceive no sound of that part of the water next him, yet he is well assured, that part contributes as much, to the roaring of the sea, as any other part, of the same quantity, so also, thought we perceive no great unquietness, in one, or two men, yet we may be well assured, that their singular passions, are parts of the seditious roaring of a troubled nation. And if there were nothing else that bewrayed their madness, yet that very arrogating such inspiration to themselves, is argument enough. If some man in bedlam should entertain you with sober discourse, and you desire in taking leave, to know what he were, that you might another time requite his civility, and he should tell you, he were God the Father, I think you need expect no extravagant action for argument of his madness. This opinion of inspiration, called commonly, private spirit, begins very often, from some lucky finding of an error generally held by others, and not knowing, or not remembering, by what conduct of reason, they came to so singular a truth, as they think it, though it be many times an untruth they light on, they presently admire themselves, as being in the special grace of God Almighty, who hath revealed the same to them supernaturally, by his Spirit. Again, that madness is nothing else, but too much appearing passion, may be gathered out of the effects of wine, which are the same with those of the evil disposition of the organs. For the variety of behavior in men that have drunk too much, is the same with that of madmen, some of them raging, others loving, others laughing, all extravagantly, but according to their several domineering passions, for the effect of the wine, does but remove dissimulation, and take from them the sight of the deformity of their passions. For, I believe, the most sober men, when they walk alone without care and employment of the mind, would be unwilling the vanity and extravagance of their thoughts at that time should be publicly seen, which is a confession, that passions unguided, are for the most part mere madness. The opinions of the world, both in antient and later ages, concerning the cause of madness, have been two. Some, deriving them from the passions, some, from demons, or spirits, either good, or bad, which they thought might enter into a man, possess him, and move his organs in such strange, and uncouth manner, as madmen used to do. The former sort therefore, called such men, madmen, but the later, called them sometimes demoniacs, that is, possessed with spirits, sometimes energumeni, that is agitated, or moved with spirits, and now in Italy they are called not only posse, madmen, but also spiritati, men possessed. There was once a great conflux of people in Abdera, a city of the Greeks, at the acting of the tragedy of Andromeda, upon an extreme hot day, whereupon, a great many of the spectators falling into fevers, had this accident from the heat, and from the tragedy together, that they did nothing but pronounce iambics, with the names of Perseus and Andromeda, which together with the fever, was cured, by the coming on of winter, and this madness was thought to proceed from the passion imprinted by the tragedy. Likewise there reigned a fit of madness in another Grecian city, which seized only the young maidens, and caused many of them to hang themselves. This was by most then thought an act of the devil. But one that suspected, that contempt of life in them, might proceed from some passion of the mind, and supposing they did not contemn also their honor, gave counsel to the magistrates, to strip such as so hang themselves, and let them hang out naked. This the story says cured that madness. But on the other side, the same Graecians, did often ascribe madness, to the operation of the Eumenides, or Furies, and sometimes of Ceres, Phoebus, and other gods, so much did men attribute to phantasms, as to think them aerial living bodies, and generally to call them spirits. And as the Romans in this, held the same opinion with the Greeks, so also did the Jews, for they chiam admon prophets, or, according as they thought the spirits good or bad, demoniacs, and some of them called both prophets, and demoniacs, madmen, and some called the same man both demoniac, and madman. But for the Gentiles, 'tis no wonder, because diseases, and health, vices, and virtues, and many natural accidents, were with them termed, and worshipped as demons. So that a man was to understand by demon, as well, sometimes, an ague, as a divel. But for the Jews to have such opinion, is somewhat strange. For neither Moses, nor Abraham pretended to prophecy by possession of a spirit, but from the voice of God, or by a vision or dream, nor is there anything in his law, moral, or ceremonial, by which they were taught, there was any such enthusiasm, or any possession. When God is sighed, No. 11:25, to take from the spirit that was in Moses, and give it to the 70 elders, the spirit of God, taking it for the substance of God, is not divided. The scriptures by the spirit of God in man, mean a man's spirit, inclined to godliness. And where it is said, Exod 28. 3, whom I have filled with the spirit of wisdom to make garments for Aaron, is not man a spirit put into them, that can make garments, but the wisdom of their own spirits in that kind of work. In the like sense, the spirit of man, when it produceth unclean actions, is ordinarily called an unclean spirit, and so other spirits, though not always, yet as often as the virtue or vice so styled, is extraordinary, and eminent. Neither did the other prophets of the Old Testament pretend enthusiasm, or, that God spake in them, but to them by voice, vision, or dream, and the burthen of the Lord was not possession, but command. How then could the Jews fall into this opinion of possession? I can imagine no reason, but that which is common to all men, namely, the want of curiosity to search natural causes, and their placing felicity, in the acquisition of the grosser pleasures of the senses, and the things that most immediately conduce thereto. For they that see any strange, and unusual ability, or defect in a man's mind, unless they see withal, from what cause it may probably proceed, can hardly think it natural, and if not natural, they must needs think it supernatural, and then what can it be, but that either God, or the devil is in him. And hence it came to pass when our Savior, Mark 3.21, was compassed about with the multitude, those of the house doubted he was mad, and went out to hold him, but the scribes said he had Beelzebub, and that was it, by which he cast out devils, as if the greater madman had awed the lesser. And that, John 10:20, some said, he hath a devil, and is mad, whereas others holding him for a prophet, sighed, these are not the words of one that hath a devil. So in the Old Testament he that came to anoint Jehu, 2 Kings 9.11, was a prophet, but some of the company asked Jehu, what came that madman for? So that in some, it is manifest, that whosoever behaved himself in extraordinary manner, was thought by the Jews to be possessed either with a good, or a vil spirit, except by the Sadducees, who erred so far on the other hand, as not to believe there were at all any spirits, which is very near to direct atheism, and thereby perhaps the more provoked others, to term such men demoniacs, rather than madmen. But why then does our Savior proceed in the curing of them, as if they were possessed, and not as if they were mad? To which I can give no other kind of answer, but that which is given to those that urge the Scripture in like manner against the opinion of the motion of the earth. The Scripture was written to show unto men the kingdom of God, and to prepare their minds to become his obedient subjects, leaving the world, and the philosophy thereof, to the disputation of men, for the exercising of their natural reason. Whether the earth's, or sun's motion make the day, and night, or whether the exorbitant actions of men, proceed from passion, or from the devil, so we worship him not, it is all one, as to our obedience, and subjection to God Almighty, which is the thing for which the Scripture was written. As for that our Savior speaketh to the disease, as to a person, it is the usual phrase of all that cure by words only, as Christ did, and enchanters pretend to do, whether they speak to a devil or not, for is not Christ also said, Matt. 8.26, to have rebuked the winds? Is not he said also, look. 4:39, to rebuke a fever? Yet this does not argue that a fever is a devil. And whereas many of these devils are said to confess Christ, it is not necessary to interpret those places otherwise, than that those madmen confessed him. And whereas our Savior, Matt. 12:43, speaketh of an unclean spirit, that having gone out of a man, wandereth through dry places, seeking rest, and finding none, and returning into the same man, with seven other spirits worse than himself, it is manifestly a parable, alluding to a man, that after a little endeavor to quit his lusts, is vanquished by the strength of them, and becomes seven times worse than he was. So that I see nothing at all in the Scripture, that requireth a belief, that demoniacs were any other thing but madmen. Insignificant speech. There is yet another fault in the discourses of some men, which may also be numbered amongst the sorts of madness, namely, that abuse of words, whereof I have spoken before in the fifth chapter, by the name of absurdity. And that is, when men speak such words, as put together, having them no signification at all, but are fallen upon by some, through misunderstanding of the words they have received, and repeat by rote, by others, from intention to deceive by obscurity. And this is incident to none but those, that converse in questions of matters incomprehensible, as the schoolmen, or in questions of abstruse philosophy. The common sort of men seldom speak insignificantly, and are therefore, by those other egregious persons counted idiots. But to be assured their words are without anything correspondent to them in the mind, there would need some examples, which if any man require, let him take a schoolman into his hands, and see if he can translate any one chapter concerning any difficult point, as the Trinity, the Deity, the nature of Christ, transubstantiation, free will, and see, into any of the modern tongues, so as to make the same intelligible, or into any tolerable Latine, such as they were acquainted with all, that lived when the Latine tongue was vulgar. What is the meaning of these words? The first cause does not necessarily inflow anything into the second, by force of the essential subordination of the second causes, by which it may help it to work. They are the translation of the title of the sixth chapter of Suarez's first book, of the concourse, motion, and help of God. When men write whole volumes of such stuff, are they not mad, or intend to make others so? And particularly, in the question of transubstantiation, where after certain words spoken, they that say, the whiteness, roundness, magnitude, quality, corruptibility, all which are incorporeal, and see, go out of the wafer, into the body of our blessed Savior, do they not make those nesesh, tudes, and ties, to be so many spirits possessing his body? For by spirits, they mean always things, that being incorporeal, are nevertheless movable from one place to another. So that this kind of absurdity, may rightly be numbered amongst the many sorts of madness, and all the time that guided by clear thoughts of their worldly lust, they forbear disputing, or writing thus, but lucid intervals. And thus much of the virtues and defects intellectual. Chapter 9. Of the several subjects of knowledge. There are of knowledge two kinds, whereof one is knowledge of fact, the other knowledge of the consequence of one affirmation to another. The former is nothing else, but sense and memory, and is absolute knowledge, as when we see a fact doing, or remember it done, and this is the knowledge required in a witness. The latter is called science, and is conditional, as when we know, that, if the figure shown be a circle, then any straight line through the center shall divide it into two equal parts. And this is the knowledge required in a philosopher, that is to say, of him that pretends to reasoning. The register of knowledge of fact is called history. Whereof there be two sorts, one called natural history, which is the history of such facts, or effects of nature, as have no dependence on man's will, such as are the histories of metals, plants, animals, regions, and the like. The other, is civil history, which is the history of the voluntary actions of men in commonwealths. The registers of science, are such books as contain the demonstrations of consequences of one affirmation, to another, and are commonly called books of philosophy, whereof the sorts are many, according to the diversity of the matter, and may be divided in such manner as I have divided them in the following table. I. Science, that is, knowledge of consequences, which is called also philosophy. A. Consequences from accidents of bodies natural, which is called natural philosophy. 1. Consequences from the accidents common to all bodies natural, which are quantity, and motion. A. Consequences from quantity, and motion indeterminate, which, being the principles or first foundation of philosophy, is called philosophia prima. Philosophia prima. B. Consequences from motion, and quantity determined. 1. Consequences from quantity, and motion determined. A. By figure, by number. 1. Mathematics. Geometry arithmetic. 2. Consequences from the motion, and quantity of bodies in special. A. Consequences from the motion, and quantity of the great parts of the world, as the earth and stars. 1. Cosmography. Astronomy geography. B. Consequences from the motion of special kinds and figures of body. 1. Mechanics, doctrine of weight. Science of engineers, architecture, navigation. 2. Physics, or consequences from qualities. A. Consequences from the qualities of bodies transient, such as sometimes appear, sometimes vanish. Meteorology. B. Consequences from the qualities of bodies permanent. 1. Consequences from the qualities of the stars. A. Consequences from the light of the stars. Out of this, and the motion of the Sunna, is made the science of Seography. B. Consequences from the influence of the stars. Astrology. 2. Consequences of the qualities from liquid bodies that fill the space between the stars, such as are the air, or substance ethereal. 3. Consequences from qualities of bodies terrestrial. A. Consequences from parts of the earth that are without sense. 1. Consequences from qualities of minerals, as stones, metals, and C2, consequences from the qualities of vegetables. B. Consequences from qualities of animals. 1. Consequences from qualities of animals in general. A. Consequences from vision. Optique. B. Consequences from sounds. Musique. C. Consequences from the rest of the senses. 2. Consequences from qualities of men in special. A. Consequences from passions of men. Ethics. B. Consequences from speech. I. In magnifying, vilifying, etc. Poetry. 2. In persuading. Rhetoric. 3. In reasoning. Logique. 4. In contracting. The science of just and unjust. B. Consequences from the accidents of politique bodies, which is called politique, and civil philosophy. 1. Of consequences from the institution of commonwealths, to the rights and duties of the body politique, or sovereign. 2. Of consequences from the same, to the duty and right of the subjects. Chapter 10. Of power, worth, dignity, honor and worthiness. Power. The power of a man, to take it universally, is his present means, to obtain some future apparent good, and is either original or instrumental. Natural power is the eminence of the faculties of body or mind, as extraordinary strength, form, prudence, arts, eloquence, liberality, nobility. Instrumental are those powers which, acquired by these or by fortune, are means and instruments to acquire more, as riches, reputation, friends, and the secret working of God, which men call good luck. For the nature of power is in this point, like to fame, increasing as it proceeds, or like the motion of heavy bodies, which the further they go, make still the more haste. The greatest of humane powers is that which is compounded of the powers of most men, united by consent, in one person, natural or civil, that has the use of all their powers depending on his will, such as is the power of a commonwealth, or depending on the wills of each particular, such as is the power of a faction, or of divers factions leagued. Therefore, to have servants is power, to have friends is power, for they are strengths united. Also riches joined with liberality is power, because it procureth friends and servants. Without liberality, not so, because in this case they defend not, but expose man to envy, as a prey. Reputation of power is power, because it draweth with it the adherence of those that need protection. So is reputation of love of a man's country, called popularity, for the same reason. Also, what quality soever maketh a man beloved, or feared of many, or the reputation of such quality, is power, because it is a means to have the assistance and service of many. Good success is power, because it maketh reputation of wisdom, or good fortune, which makes men either fear him, or rely on him. Affability of men already in power, is increase of power, because it gaineth love. Reputation of prudence in the conduct of peace or war, is power, because to prudent men, we commit the government of ourselves, more willingly than to others. Nobility is power, not in all places, but only in those commonwealths where it has privileges, for in such privileges consisteth their power. Eloquence is power, because it is seeming prudence. Form is power, because being a promise of good, it recommendeth men to the favor of women and strangers. The sciences are small power, because not eminent, and therefore not acknowledged in any man, nor at all, but in a few, and in them, but of a few things. For science is of that nature, as none can understand it to be, but such as in a good measure have attained it. arts of public use, as fortification, making of engines, and other instruments of war, because they confer to defense, and victory, our power, and though the true mother of them, be science, namely the mathematics, yet, because they are brought into light, by the hand of the artificer, they be esteemed, the midwife passing with the vulgar for the mother, as his issue. Worth. The value, or worth of a man, is as of all other things, his price, that is to say, so much as would be given for the use of his power, and therefore is not absolute, but a thing dependent on the need and judgment of another. An able conductor of soldiers, is of great price in time of war present, or imminent, but in peace not so. A learned and uncorrupt judge, is much worth in time of peace, but not so much in war. And as in other things, so in men, not the seller, but the buyer determines the price. For let a man, as most men do, rate themselves as the highest value they can, yet their true value is no more than it is esteemed by others. The manifestation of the value we set on one another, is that which is commonly called honoring, and dishonoring. To value a man at a high rate, is to honor him, at a low rate, is to dishonor him. But high, and low, in this case, is to be understood by comparison to the rate that each man setteth on himself. Dignity. The public worth of a man, which is the value set on him by the commonwealth, is that which men commonly call dignity. And this value of him by the commonwealth, is understood, by offices of command, judicature, public employment, or by names and titles, introduced for distinction of such value. To honor and dishonor. To pray to another, for aid of any kind, is to honor, because a signal we have an opinion he has power to help, and the more difficult the aid is, the more is the honor. To obey, is to honor, because no man obeys them, whom they think have no power to help, or hurt them. And consequently to disobey, is to dishonor. To give great gifts to a man, is to honor him, because 'tis buying of protection, and acknowledging of power. To give little gifts, is to dishonor, because it is but alms, and signifies an opinion of the need of small helps. To be sedulous in promoting another's good, also to flatter, is to honor, as a signal we seek his protection or aid. To neglect, is to dishonor. To give way, or place to another, in any commodity, is to honor, being a confession of greater power. To arrogate, is to dishonor. To show any sign of love, or fear of another, is to honor, for both to love, and to fear, is to value. To contemn, or less to love or fear than he expects, is to dishonor, for 'tis undervaluing. To praise, magnify, or call happy, is to honor, because nothing but goodness, power, and felicity is valued. To revile, mock, or pity, is to dishonor. To speak to another with consideration, to appear before him with decency, and humility, is to honor him, as senior of fear to offend. To speak to him rashly, to do anything before him obscenely, slovenly, impudently, is to dishonor. To believe, to trust, to rely on another, is to honor him, sign of opinion of his virtue and power. To distrust, or not believe, is to dishonor. To hearken to a man's counsel, or discourse of what kind soever, is to honor, as a signal we think him wise, or eloquent, or witty. To sleep, or go forth, or talk the while, is to dishonor. To do those things to another, which he takes for signa of honor, or which the law or custom makes so, is to honor, because in approving the honor done by others, he acknowledgeth the power which others acknowledge. To refuse to do them, is to dishonor. To agree with an opinion, is to honor, as being a signa of approving his judgment, and wisdom. To dissent, is dishonor, and an upbraiding of error, and, if the dissent be in many things, of folly. To imitate, is to honor, for it is vehemently to approve. To imitate one's enemy, is to dishonor. To honor those another honors, is to honor him, as a signa of approbation of his judgment. To honor his enemies, is to dishonor him. To employ in counsel, or in actions of difficulty, is to honor, as a signa of opinion of his wisdom, or other power. To deny employment in the same cases, to those that seek it, is to dishonor. All these ways of honoring, are natural, and as well within, as without commonwealths. But in commonwealths, where he, or they that have the supreme authority, can make whatsoever they please, to stand for signa of honor, there be other honors. A sovereign doth honor a subject, with whatsoever title, or office, or employment, or action, that he himself will have taken for a signa of his will to honor him. The king of Persia, honored Mordecai, when he appointed he should be conducted through the streets in the king's garment, upon one of the king's horses, with a crown on his head, and a prince before him, proclaiming, "Thus shall it be done to him that the king will honor." And yet another king of Persia, or the same another time, to one that demanded for some great service, to wear one of the king's robes, gave him leave so to do, but with his addition, that he should wear it as the king's fool, and then it was dishonor. So that of civil honor, such as our magistracy, offices, titles, and in some places coats, and scutcheons painted, and men honor such as have them, as having so many signia of favor in the commonwealth, which favor is power. Honorable is whatsoever possession, action, or quality, is an argument and signa of power. And therefore to be honored, loved, or feared of many, is honorable, as arguments of power. To be honored of few or none, dishonorable. Good fortune, if lasting, honorable, as a signa of the favor of God. Ill fortune, and losses, dishonorable. Riches, are honorable, for they are power. Poverty, dishonorable. Magnanimity, liberality, hope, courage, confidence, are honorable, for they proceed from the conscience of power. Pusillanimity, parsimony, fear, diffidence, are dishonorable. Timely resolution, or determination of what a man is to do, is honorable, as being the contempt of small difficulties and dangers. And irresolution, dishonorable, as a signa of too much valuing of little impediments and little advantages. For when a man has weighed things as long as the time permits, and resolves not, the difference of weight is but little, and therefore if he resolve not, he overvalues little things, which is pusillanimity. All actions, and speeches, that proceed, or seem to proceed from much experience, science, discretion, or wit, are honorable, for all these are powers. Actions, or words that proceed from error, ignorance, or folly, dishonorable. Gravity, as far forth as it seems to proceed from a mind employed on something else, is honorable, because employment is a signa of power. But if it seem to proceed from a purpose to appear grave, it is dishonorable. For the gravity of the former, is like the steadiness of a ship laden with merchandise, but of the latter, like the steadiness of a ship ballasted with sand, and other trash. To be conspicuous, that is to say, to be known, for wealth, office, great actions, or any eminent good, is honorable, as a signa of the power for which he is conspicuous. On the contrary, obscurity, is dishonorable. To be descended from conspicuous parents, is honorable, because they the more easily attain the aids and friends of their ancestors. On the contrary, to be descended from obscure parentage, is dishonorable. Actions proceeding from equity, joined with lossy, are honorable, as signa of magnanimity, for magnanimity is a signa of power. On the contrary, craft, shifting, neglect of equity, is dishonorable. Nor does it alter the case of honor, whether an action, so it be great and difficult, and consequently a signa of much power, be just or unjust, for honor consisteth only in the opinion of power. Therefore the ancient heathen did not think they dishonored, but greatly honored the gods, when they introduced them in their poems, committing rapes, thefts, and other great, but unjust, or unclean acts, insomuch as nothing is so much celebrated in Jupiter, as his adulteries, nor in Mercury, as his frauds, and thefts, of whose praises, in a hymn of Homer, the greatest is this, that being born in the morning, he had invented music at noon, and before night, stolen away the cattle of Apollo, from his herdsmen. Also amongst men, till there were constituted great commonwealths, it was thought no dishonor to be a pirate, or a highway thief, but rather lawful trade, not only amongst the Greeks, but also amongst all other nations, as is manifest by the histories of antient time. And at this day, in this part of the world, private duels are, and always will be honorable, though unlawful, till such time as there shall be honor ordained for them that refuse, and ignominy for them that make the challenge. For duels also are many times effects of courage, and the ground of courage is always strength or skill, which are power, though for the most part they be effects of rash speaking, and of the fear of dishonor, in one, or both the combatants, who engaged by rashness, are driven into the lists to avoid disgrace. Scutcheons, and coats of arm hereditary, where they have any eminent privileges, are honorable, otherwise not, for their power consisteth either in such privileges, or in riches, or some such thing as is equally honored in other men. This kind of honor, commonly called gentry, has been derived from the antient Germans. For there never was any such thing known, where the German customs were unknown. Nor is it now anywhere in use, where the Germans have not inhabited. The antient Greek commanders, when they went to war, had their shields painted with such devices as they pleased, insomuch as an unpainted buckler was a signa of poverty, and of a common soldier, but they transmitted not the inheritance of them. The Romans transmitted the marks of their families, but they were the images, not the devices of their ancestors. Amongst the people of Asia, Afrique, and America, there is not, nor was ever, any such thing. The Germans only had that custom, from whom it has been derived into England, France, Spain, and Italy, when in great numbers they either aided the Romans, or made their own conquests in these western parts of the world. For Germany, being anciently, as all other countries, in their beginnings, divided amongst an infinite number of little lords, or masters of families, that continually had wars one with another, those masters, or lords, principally to the end they might, when they were covered with arms, be known by their followers, and partly for ornament, both painted their armor, or their scutcheon, or coat, with the picture of some beast, or other thing, and also put some eminent and visible mark upon the crest of their helmets. And his ornament both of the armor, and crest, descended by inheritance to their children, to the eldest pure, and to the rest with some note of diversity, such as the old master, that is to say in Dutch, the herald thought fit. But when many such families, joined together, made a greater monarchy, this duty of the herald, to distinguish scutcheons, was made a private office apart. And the issue of these lords, is the great and antient gentry, which for the most part bear living creatures, noted for courage, and rapine, or castles, battlements, belts, weapons, bars, palisados, and other notes of war, nothing being then in honor, but virtu militari. Afterwards, not only kings, but popular commonwealths, gave divers manners of scutcheons, to such as went forth to the war, or returned from it, for encouragement, or recompense to their service. All which, by an observing reader, may be found in such ancient histories, Greek and Latine, as make mention of the German nation, and manners, in their times. Titles of honor. Titles of honor, such as are Duke, Count, Marquis, and Baron, are honorable, as signifying the value set upon them by the sovereign power of the Commonwealth, which titles, were in old time titles of office, and command, derived some from the Romans, some from the Germans, and French. Dukes, in Latine duces, being generals in war, counts, comites, such as bear the general company out of friendship, and were left to govern and defend places conquered, and pacified, marquises, martians, were counts that governed the marches, or bounds of the empire. Which titles of duke, count, and marquis, came into the empire, about the time of Constantine the Great, from the customs of the German militia. But baron, seems to have been a title of the Gaul, and signifies a great man, such as were the kings, or princes men, whom they employed in war about their persons, and seems to be derived from vir, to bur, and bar, that signified the same in the language of the Gaul, that vir in Latine, and thence to baro, and baro, so that such men were called barones, and after barones, and, in Spanish, varones. But he that would know more particularly the original of titles of honor, may find it, as I have done this, in Mr. Selden's most excellent treatise of that subject. In process of time these offices of honor, by occasion of trouble, and for reasons of good and peaceable government, were turned into mere titles, serving for the most part, to distinguish the precedence, place, and order of subjects in the Commonwealth, and men were made dukes, counts, marquises, and barons of places, wherein they had neither possession, nor command, and other titles also, were devised to the same end. Worthiness fitness. Worthiness, is a thing different from the worth, or value of a man, and also from his merit, or desert, and consisteth in a particular power, or ability for that, whereof he is said to be worthy, which particular ability, is usually named fitness, or aptitude. For he is worthiest to be a commander, to be a judge, or to have any other charge, that is best fitted, with the qualities required to the well discharging of it, and worthiest of riches, that has the qualities most requisite for the well using of them, any of which qualities being absent, one may nevertheless be a worthy man, and valuable for something else. Again, a man may be worthy of riches, office, and employment, that nevertheless, can plead no right to have it before another, and therefore cannot be said to merit or deserve it. For merit, presupposeth the right, and that the thing deserved is due by promise, of which I shall say more hereafter, when I shall speak of contracts. Chapter 11. Of the difference of manners. What is here meant by manners? By manners, I mean not here, decency of behavior, as how one man should salute another, or how a man should wash his mouth, or pick his teeth before company, and such other points of the small morals, but those qualities of mankind, that concern their living together in peace, and unity. To which end we are to consider, that the felicity of this life, consisteth not in the repose of a mind satisfied. For there is no such finis ultimus, utmost hame, nor summum bonum, greatest good, as is spoken of in the books of the old moral philosophers. Nor can a man any more live, whose desires are at an end, than he, whose senses and imaginations are at a stand. Felicity is a continual progress of the desire, from one object to another, the attaining of the former, being still but the way to the later. The cause whereof is, that the object of man's desire, is not to enjoy once only, and for one instant of time, but to assure forever, the way of his future desire. And therefore the voluntary actions, and inclinations of all men, tend, not only to the procuring, but also to the assuring of a contented life, and differ only in the way, which ariseth partly from the diversity of passions, in divers men, and partly from the difference of the knowledge, or opinion each one has of the causes, which produce the effect desired. A restless desire of power, in all men. So that in the first place, I put for a general inclination of all mankind, a perpetual and restless desire of power after power, that ceaseth only in death. And the cause of this, is not always that a man hopes for a more intensive delight, than he has already attained to, or that he cannot be content with the moderate power, but because he cannot assure the power and means to live well, which he hath present, without the acquisition of more. And from hence it is, that kings, whose power is greatest, turn their endeavors to the assuring at a home by laws, or abroad by wars, and when that is done, there succeedeth a new desire, in some, of fame from new conquest, in others, of ease and sensual pleasure, in others, of admiration, or being flattered for excellence in some art, or other ability of the mind. Love of contention from competition. Competition of riches, honor, command, or other power, inclineth to contention, enmity, and war, because the way of one competitor, to the attaining of his desire, is to kill, subdue, supplant, or repel the other. Particularly, competition of praise, inclineth to a reverence of antiquity. For men contend with the living, not with the dead, to these ascribing more than due, that they may obscure the glory of the other. Civil obedience from love of ease. Desire of ease, and sensual delight, disposeth men to obey a common power, because by such desires, a man doth abandon the protection might be hoped for from his own industry, and labor. From fear of death or wounds. Fear of death, and wounds, disposeth to the same, and for the same reason. On the contrary, needy men, and hardy, not contented with their present condition, as also, all men that are ambitious of military command, are inclined to continue the causes of war, and to stir up trouble and sedition, for there is no honor military but by war, nor any such hope to mend an ill game, as by causing a new shuffle. And from love of arts. Desire of knowledge, and arts of peace, inclineth men to obey a common power, for such desire, containeth a desire of leisure, and consequently protection from some other power than their own. Love of virtue, from love of praise. Desire of praise, disposeth to laudable actions, such as please them whose judgment they value, for of these men whom we contemn also the praises. Desire of fame after death does the same. And though after death, there be no sense of the praise given us on earth, as being joys, that are either swallowed up in the unspeakable joys of heaven, or extinguished in the extreme torments of hell, yet is not such fame vain, because men have a present delight therein, from the foresight of it, and of the benefit that may rebound thereby to their posterity, which though they now see not, yet they imagine, and anything that is pleasure in the sense, the same also is pleasure in the imagination. Hate, from difficulty of requiting great benefits. To have received from one, to whom we think ourselves equal, greater benefits than there is hope to requite, disposeth to counterfeit love, but really secret hatred, and puts a man into the estate of a desperate debtor, that in declining the sight of his creditor, tacitly wishes him there, where he might never see him more. For benefits oblige, and obligation is thraldom, which is to one's equal, hateful. But to have received benefits from one, whom we acknowledge our superior, inclines to love, because the obligation is no new to passion, and cheerful acceptation, which men call gratitude, is such an honor done to the obliger, as is taken generally for retribution. Also to receive benefits, though from an equal, or inferior, as long as there is hope of requital, disposeth to love, for in the intention of the receiver, the obligation is of aid, and service mutual, from whence proceedeth an emulation of who shall exceed in benefiting, the most noble and profitable contention possible, wherein the victor is pleased with his victory, and the other revenged by confessing it. And from conscience of deserving to be hated. To have done more hurt to a man, than he can, or is willing to expiate, inclineth the doer to hate the sufferer. For he must expect revenge, or forgiveness, both which are hateful. Promptness to hurt, from fear. Fear of oppression, disposeth a man to anticipate, or to seek aid by society, for there is no other way by which a man can secure his life and liberty. And from distrust of their own wit. Men that distrust their own subtlety, are in tumult, and sedition, better disposed for victory, than they that suppose themselves wise, or crafty. For these love to consult, the other, fearing to be circumvented, to strike first. And in sedition, men being always in the precincts of battle, to hold together, and use all advantages of force, is a better stratagem, than any that can proceed from subtlety of wit. Vain undertaking from vainglory. Vainglorious men, such as without being conscious to themselves of great sufficiency, delight in supposing themselves gallant men, are inclined only to ostentation, but not to attempt, because when danger or difficulty appears, they look for nothing but to have their insufficiency discovered. Vainglorious men, such as estimate their sufficiency by the flattery of other men, or the fortune of some precedent action, without assured ground of hope from the true knowledge of themselves, are inclined to rash engaging, and in the approach of danger, or difficulty, to retire if they can, because not seeing the way of safety, they will rather hazard their honor, which may be salved with an excuse, than their lives, for which no salve is sufficient. Ambition, from opinion of sufficiency. Men that have a strong opinion of their own wisdom in matter of government, are disposed to ambition. Because without public employment in council or magistracy, the honor of their wisdom is lost. And therefore eloquent speakers are inclined to ambition, for eloquence seemeth wisdom, both to themselves and others. Irresolution, from too great valuing of small matters. Pusillanimity disposeth men to irresolution, and consequently to lose the occasions, and fittest opportunities of action. For after men have been in deliberation till the time of action approach, if it be not then manifest what is best to be done, 'tis a signa, the difference of motives, the one way and the other, are not great, therefore not to resolve then, is to lose the occasion by weighing of trifles, which is pusillanimity. Frugality, though in poor men a virtue, maketh a man unapt to achieve such actions, as require the strength of many men at once, for it weakeneth their endeavor, which is to be nourished and kept in vigor by reward. Confidence in others from ignorance of the marks of wisdom and kindness a eloquence, with flattery, disposeth men to confide in them that have it, because the former is seeming wisdom, the later seeming kindness a honor to the military reputation, and it disposeth men to adhere, and subject themselves to those men that have them. The two former, having given them caution against danger from him, the later gives them caution against danger from others. And from the ignorance of natural causes. One of science, that is, ignorance of causes, disposeth, or rather constraineth a man to rely on the advice, and authority of others. For all men whom the truth concerns, if they rely not on their own, must rely on the opinion of some other, whom they think wiser than themselves, and see not why he should deceive them. And from one of understanding. Ignorance of the signification of words, which is, one of understanding, disposeth men to take on trust, not only the truth they know not, but also the errors, and which is more, the nonsense of them they trust, for neither error, nor nonsense, can without a perfect understanding of words, be detected. From the same it proceedeth, that men give different names, to one and the same thing, from the difference of their own passions, as they that approve a private opinion, call it opinion, but they that mislike it, heresy, and yet heresy signifies no more than private opinion, but has only a greater tincture of color. From the same also it proceedeth, that men cannot distinguish, without study and great understanding, between one action of many men, and many actions of one multitude, as for example, between the one action of all the senators of Rome in killing Catiline, and the many actions of a number of senators in killing Caesar, and therefore are disposed to take for the action of the people, that which is a multitude of actions done by a multitude of men, led perhaps by the persuasion of one. Adherence to custom, from ignorance of the nature of right and wrong, ignorance of the causes, and original constitution of right, equity, law, and justice, disposeth a man to make custom an example the rule of his actions, in such manner, as to think that unjust which it hath been the custom to punish, and that just, of the impunity and approbation whereof they can produce an example, or, as the lawyers which wantonly use the false measure of justice barbarously call it, a precedent, like little children, that have no other rule of good and of ill manners, but the correction they receive from their parents, and masters, save that children are constant to their rule, whereas men are not so, because grown strong, and stubborn, they appeal from custom to reason, and from reason to custom, as it serves their turn, receding from custom when their interest requires it, and setting themselves against reason, as oft as reason is against them, which is the cause, that the doctrine of right and wrong, is perpetually disputed, both by the pen and the sword, whereas the doctrine of lines, and figures, is not so, because men care not, in that subject what be truth, as a thing that crosses no man's ambition, profit, or lust. For I doubt not, but if it had been a thing contrary to any man's right of dominion, or to the interest of men that have dominion, that the three angles of a triangle should be equal to two angles of a square, that doctrine should have been, if not disputed, yet by the burning of all books of geometry, suppressed, as far as he whom it concerned was able. Adherence to private men, from ignorance of the causes of peace, ignorance of remote causes, disposeth men to attribute all events to the causes immediate and instrumental, for these are all the causes they perceive. And hence it comes to pass, that in all places, men that are grieved with payments to the public, discharge their anger upon the publicans, that is to say, farmers, collectors, and other officers of the public revenue, and adhere to such as find fault with the public government, and thereby, when they have engaged themselves beyond hope of justification, fall also upon the supreme authority, for fear of punishment, or shame of receiving pardon. Credulity from ignorance of nature. Ignorance of natural causes disposeth the man to credulity, so as to believe many times in possibilities, for such know nothing to the contrary, but that they may be true, being unable to detect the impossibility. And credulity, because men love to be hearkened unto in company, disposeth them to lying, so that ignorance itself without malice, is able to make a man both to believe lies, and tell them, and sometimes also to invent them. Curiosity to know, from care of future time. Anxiety for the future time, disposeth men to inquire into the causes of things, because the knowledge of them, maketh men the better able to order the present to their best advantage. Natural religion, from the same. Curiosity, or love of the knowledge of causes, draws a man from consideration of the effect, to seek the cause, and again, the cause of that cause, till of necessity he must come to this thought at last, that there is some cause, whereof there is no former cause, but is eternal, which is it men call God. So that it is impossible to make any profound inquiry into natural causes, without being inclined thereby to believe there is one God eternal, though they cannot have any idea of him in their mind, answerable to his nature. For as a man that is born blind, hearing men talk of warming themselves by the fire, and being brought to warm himself by the same, may easily conceive, and assure himself, there is somewhat there, which men call fire, and is the cause of the heat he feels, but cannot imagine what it is like, nor have an idea of it in his mind, such as they have that see it. So also, by the visible things of this world, and their admirable order, a man may conceive there is a cause of them, which men call God, and yet not have an idea, or image of him in his mind. And they that make little, or no inquiry into the natural causes of things, yet from the fear that proceeds from the ignorance itself, of what it is that hath the power to do them much good or harm, are inclined to suppose, and feign unto themselves, sever all kinds of powers invisible, and to stand in awe of their own imaginations, and in time of distress to invoke them, as also in the time of an expected good success, to give them thanks, making the creatures of their own fancy, their gods. By which means it hath come to pass, that from the innumerable variety of fancy, men have created in the world innumerable sorts of gods. And this fear of things invisible, is the natural seed of that, which every one in himself calleth religion, and in them that worship, or fear that power otherwise than they do, superstition. And this seed of religion, having been observed by many, some of those that have observed it, have been inclined thereby to nourish, dress, and form it into laws, and to add to it of their own invention, any opinion of the causes of future events, by which they thought they should best be able to govern others, and make unto themselves the greatest use of their powers. Chapter 12. Of Religion. Religion, in man only. Seeing there are no signa, nor fruit of religion, but in man only, there is no cause to doubt, but that the seed of religion, is also only in man, and consisteth in some peculiar quality, or at least in some eminent degree thereof, not to be found in other living creatures. First, from his desire of knowing causes. And first, it is peculiar to the nature of man, to be inquisitive into the causes of the events they see, some more, some less, but all men so much, as to be curious in the search of the causes of their own good and of ill fortune. From the consideration of the beginning of things. Secondly, upon the sight of anything that hath a beginning, to think also it had a cause, which determined the same to begin, then when it did, rather than sooner or later. From his observation of the sequel of things. Thirdly, whereas there is no other felicity of beasts, but the enjoying of their quotidian food, ease, and lusts, as having little, or no foresight of the time to come, for one of observation, and memory of the order, consequence, and dependence of the things they see, man observeth how one event hath been produced by another, and remembereth in them antecedents and consequence, and when he cannot assure himself of the true causes of things, for the causes of good and of ill fortune for the most part are invisible, he supposes causes of them, either such as his own fancy suggesteth, or trusteth to the authority of other men, such as he thinks to be his friends, and wiser than himself. The natural cause of religion, the anxiety of the time to come, the two first, make anxiety. For being assured that there be causes of all things that have arrived hitherto, or shall arrive hereafter, it is impossible for a man, who continually endeavoureth to secure himself against the evil he fears, and procure the good he desireth, not to be in a perpetual solicitude of the time to come, so that every man, especially those that are over-provident, are in an estate like to that of Prometheus. For as Prometheus, which interpreted, is, the prudent man, was bound to the hill Caucasus, a place of large prospect, where, an eagle feeding on his liver, devoured in the day, as much as was repaired in the night, so that man, which looks too far before him, in the care of future time, hath his heart all the day long, gnawed on by fear of death, poverty, or other calamity, and has no repose, nor pause of his anxiety, but in sleep. Which makes them fear the power of invisible things. This perpetual fear, always accompanying mankind in the ignorance of causes, as it were in the dark, must needs have for object something. And therefore when there is nothing to be seen, there is nothing to accuse, either of their good, or of ill fortune, but some power, or agent invisible, in which sense perhaps it was, that some of the old poets said, that the gods were at first created by humane fear, which spoken of the gods, that is to say, of the many gods of the Gentiles, is very true. But the acknowledging of one God eternal, infinite, and omnipotent, may more easily be derived, from the desire men have to know the causes of natural bodies, and their several virtues, and operations, than from the fear of what was to befall them in time to come. For he that from any effect he seeth come to pass a, should reason to the next and immediate cause thereof, and from thence to the cause of that cause, and plunge himself profoundly in the pursuit of causes, shall at last come to this, that there must be, as even the heathen philosophers confessed, one first mover, that is, a first, and an eternal cause of all things, which is that which men mean by the name of God, and all this without thought of their fortune, the solicitude whereof, both inclines to fear, and hinders them from the search of the causes of other things, and thereby gives occasion of feigning of as many gods, as there be men that feign them, and suppose them incorporeal. And for the matter, or substance of the invisible agents, so fancied, they could not by natural cogitation, fall upon any other conceit, but that it was the same with that of the soul of man, and that the soul of man, was of the same substance, with that which appeareth in a dream, to one that sleepeth, or in a looking glass, to one that is awake, which, men not knowing that such apparitions are nothing else but creatures of the fancy, think to be real, and external substances, and therefore call them ghosts, as the Latins called them imagines, and umbri, and thought them spirits, that is, funereal bodies, and those invisible agents, which they feared, to be like them, save that they appear, and vanish when they please. But the opinion that such spirits were incorporeal, or immaterial, could never enter into the mind of any man by nature, because, though man may put together words of contradictory signification, as spirit, and incorporeal, yet they can never have the imagination of anything answering to them, and therefore, men that by their own meditation, arrive to the acknowledgement of one infinite, omnipotent, and eternal God, choose rather to confess he is incomprehensible, and above their understanding, than to define his nature by spirit incorporeal, and then confess their definition to be unintelligible, or if they give him such a title, it is not dogmatically, with intention to make the divine nature understood, but piously, to honor him with attributes, of significations, as remote as they can from the grossness of bodies visible. But know not the way how they affect anything. Then, for the way by which they think these invisible agents wrought their effects, that is to say, what immediate causes they used, in bringing things to pass a, men that know not what it is that we call causing, that is, almost all men, have no other rule to guess by, but by observing, and remembering what they have seen to perceive the like effect at some other time, or times before, without seeing between the antecedent and subsequent event, any dependence or connection at all, and therefore from the like things past, they expect the like things to come, and hope for good or of ill luck, superstitiously, from things that have no part at all in the causing of it, as the Athenians did for their war at Lepanto, demand another Phormio, the Pompeian faction for their war in Afrique, another Scipio, and others have done in divers other occasions since. In like manner they attribute their fortune to a stander by, to a lucky or unlucky place, to words spoken, especially if the name of God be amongst them, as charming, and conjuring, the liturgy of witches, insomuch as to believe, they have power to turn a stone into bread, bread into a man, or anything, into anything. But honor them as they honor men. Thirdly, for the worship which naturally men exhibit to powers invisible, it can be no other, but such expressions of their reverence, as they would use towards men, gifts, petitions, thanks, submission of body, considerate addresses, sober behavior, premeditated words, swearing, that is, assuring one another of their promises, by invoking them. Beyond that reason suggesteth nothing, but leaves them either to rest there, or for further ceremonies, to rely on those they believe to be wiser than themselves, and attribute to them all extraordinary events. Lastly, concerning how these invisible powers declare to men the things which shall hereafter come to pass, especially concerning their good or evil fortune in general, or good or ill success in any particular undertaking, men are naturally at a stand, save that using to conjecture of the time to come, by the time past, they are very apt, not only to take casual things, after one or two encounters, for prognostics of the like encounter ever after, but also to believe the like prognostics from other men, of whom they have once conceived a good opinion. Four things, natural seeds of religion. And in these four things, opinion of ghosts, ignorance of second causes, devotion towards what men fear, and taking of things casual for prognostics, consisteth the natural seed of religion, which by reason of the different fancies, judgments, and passions of several men, hath grown up into ceremonies so different, that those which are used by one man, are for the most part ridiculous to another, made different by culture. For these seeds have received culture from two sorts of men. One sort have been they, that have nourished, and ordered them, according to their own invention. The other, have done it, by God's commandment, and direction, but both sorts have done it, with a purpose to make those men that relied on them, the more apt to obedience, laws, peace, charity, and civil society. So that the religion of the former sort, is a part of humane politique, and teacheth part of the duty which earthly kings require of their subjects. And the religion of the later sort is divine politique, and containeth precepts to those that have yielded themselves subjects in the kingdom of God. Of the former sort, were all the founders of commonwealths, and the lawgivers of the Gentiles; of the later sort, were Abraham, Moses, and our blessed Savior, by whom have been derived unto us the laws of the kingdom of God. The absurd opinion of Gentilism. And for that part of religion, which consisteth in opinions concerning the nature of powers invisible, there is almost nothing that has a name, that has not been esteemed amongst the Gentiles, in one place or another, a god, or divel, or by their poets feigned to be inanimated, inhabited, or possessed by some spirit or other. The unformed matter of the world, was a god, by the name of Chaos. The heaven, the ocean, the planets, the fire, the earth, the winds, were so many gods. Men, women, a bird, a crocodile, a calf, a dogge, a snake, an onion, a leek, deified. Besides, that they filled almost all places, with spirits called demons, the plains, with Pan, and Panises, or satyrs, the woods, with fauns, and nymphs, the sea, with tritons, and other nymphs, every river, and fountain, with a ghost of his name, and with nymphs, every house, with it lares, or familiars, every man, with his genius, hell, with ghosts, and spiritual officers, as Charon, Cerberus, and the Furies, and in the night time, all places with larvae, lemurs, ghosts of men deceased, and a whole kingdom of fairies, and bugbears. They have also ascribed divinity, and built temples to mere accidents, and qualities, such as are time, night, day, peace, concord, love, contention, virtue, honor, health, rust, fever, and the like, which when they prayed for, or against, they prayed to, as if there were ghosts of those names hanging over their heads, and letting fall, or withholding that good, or evil, for, or against which they prayed. They invoked also their own wit, by the name of Muses, their own ignorance, by the name of Fortune, their own lust, by the name of Cupid, their own rage, by the name Furies, their own privy members by the name of Priapus, and attributed their pollutions, to incubi, and succubi, insomuch as there was nothing, which a poet could introduce as a person in his poem, which they did not make either a god, or a devil. The same authors of the Religion of the Gentiles, observing the second ground for religion, which is men's ignorance of causes, and thereby their aptness to attribute their fortune to causes, on which there was no dependence at all apparent, took occasion to obtrude on their ignorance, instead of second causes, a kind of second and ministerial gods, ascribing the cause of fecundity, to Venus, the cause of arts, to Apollo, of subtlety and craft, to Mercury, of tempests and storms, to Elis, and of other effects, to other gods, insomuch as there was amongst the heathen almost as great variety of gods, as of business. And to the worship, which naturally men conceived fit to be used towards their gods, namely oblations, prayers, thanks, and the rest formerly named, the same legislators of the Gentiles have added their images, both in picture, and sculpture, that the more ignorant sort, that is to say, the most part, or generality of the people, thinking the gods for whose representation they were made, were really included, and as it were housed within them, might so much the more stand in fear of them, and endow them with lands, and houses, and officers, and revenues, set apart from all other humane uses, that is, consecrated, and made holy to those their idols, as caverns, groves, woods, mountains, and holy lands, and have attributed to them, not only the shapes, some of men, some of beasts, some of monsters, but also the faculties, and passions of men and beasts, as sense, speech, sex, lust, generation, and this not only by mixing one with another, to propagate the kind of gods, but also by mixing with men, and women, to beget mongrel gods, and but inmates of heaven, as Bacchus, Hercules, and others, besides, anger, revenge, and other passions of living creatures, and the actions proceeding from them, as fraud, theft, adultery, sodomy, and any vice that may be taken for an effect of power, or a cause of pleasure, and all such vices, as amongst men are taken to be against law, rather than against honor. Lastly, to the prognostics of time to come, which are naturally, but conjectures upon the experience of time past, and supernatural, divine revelation, the same authors of the Religion of the Gentiles, partly upon pretended experience, partly upon pretended revelation, have added innumerable other superstitious ways of divination, and made men believe they should find their fortunes, sometimes in the ambiguous or senseless answers of the priests at Delphi, Delos, Ammon, and other famous oracles, which answers, were made ambiguous by design, to own the event both ways, or absurd by the intoxicating vapor of the place, which is very frequent in sulphurous cavern, sometimes in the leaves of the Sibyls, of whose prophecies, like those perhaps of Nostradamus, for the fragments now extant seem to be the invention of later times, there were some books in reputation in the time of the Roman Republic, sometimes in the insignificant speeches of madmen, supposed to be possessed with a divine spirit, which possession they called enthusiasm, and these kinds of foretelling events, were accounted theomancy, or prophecy, sometimes in the aspect of the stars of their nativity, which was called horoscopy, and esteemed a part of judiciary astrology, sometimes in their own hopes and fears, called thumomancy, or presage, sometimes in the prediction of witches, that pretended conference with the dead, which is called necromancy, conjuring, and witchcraft, and is but juggling and confederate knavery, sometimes in the casual flight, or feeding of birds, called augury, sometimes in the entrails of a sacrificed beast, which was Aruspicina, sometimes in dreams, sometimes in croaking of ravens, or a chattering of birds, sometimes in the lineaments of